The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 12th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. It's Casual Friday, ladies and gentlemen. But nothing casual at all about today. We are jam-packed at Netroots Nation 2019. We will have a series of interviews today emanating from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I will be talking to an array of folks on various issues and going on here, so bear with me, a little bit hectic, but we've got it going. Adele Stan. Nope. Let me turn on your mic. It's one of those days, folks, and I got to be honest with you. It's not like I just went home and took a nap last night. No. Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. Try that one more time. Adele Stan.
Hi, Sam. Great to be with you.
From the Right Wing Watch?
Yes, indeed.
You're our second guest from the Right Wing Watch on the program.
Oh, my goodness.
Right wing, lot to watch.
There's a lot to watch. Well, you know, I just did a panel today at Netroots about the rise of right wing authoritarianism. And basically my mantra is this, Sam. It's the right wing, the far right is a global movement, number one. Number two, the far right is not fringe. It's at the heart of power. And we see this every day, of course, with this administration.
Now, I mean, let's talk about right wing authoritarianism, because I'm trying to think of the author. He was a Canadian professor.
Yeah.
And John Dean based a lot of what he wrote in his book about conservatives about maybe 10 years ago, based on the work of this author from Canada, who suggested there at any given point in North America, there's about 25% of the population are right-wing authoritarians. And there is a left-wing authoritarianism, but it's just not as prevalent because of the nature of the left.
Right.
What do you think it is about this era that has brought it? I mean, is it just a function of Trump? Because you're talking about it being international. So what is that?
Well, it's, you know, this is, I would say that author is correct. I mean, I haven't read his particular work, but I mean, we see that about 24% of the U.S. electorate, and that's, you know, the electorate, not the general population. Unfortunately, a lot of our people don't vote, but 24% of the U.S. electorate is right-wing evangelicals. So that sounds like a credible figure to me. I think this is a strain of Americanism that has existed for a very long time, you know, in terms of the American form, the U.S. form of right-wing authoritarianism. And the right wing has been building this thing, this apparatus, for 40 years, while, you know, the left has been less involved in building infrastructure in the way that the right has. So if you look at the ideology of, say, white, what we call white nationalists now, and the ideology of, say, the Family Research Council, you're not going to find a whole lot of daylight between, you know, the viewpoints.
It's Bob Altemeyer was the author, and he worth tracking down. I tried to talk to him about a year or two ago to see if he would come on. He had issued actually a warning in the run up to the election about Donald Trump. He had some belief that Donald Trump was going to win.
I did,
because
too.
These authoritarians were going to be activated. He was very nervous. And I spoke to him a couple of times to try and get him on the show. And frankly, he was a little bit nervous. Just not sure that he had much to say at that point.
Mm.
You know, it's tough to sort of warn people about hitting the lamppost after you've run it over.
And I think, you know, because the U.S. is, you know, got oceans on either side of it, and we have a propensity for narcissism, being the you know, the biggest, baddest nation on the face of the earth, as we like to think of ourselves, that we really haven't been paying attention to this thing as a global project, and it truly is. The religious right has been making inroads with far-right parties and actors in Europe for a very long time, and other parts of the world too, and as we see with Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, Michelle Bachmann was working with him.
Is that right?
Steve Bannon was working with
him. We should say Bolsonaro just appointed his son to be ambassador to Washington.
Well, Trump loves Bolsonaro.
Right. I mean, and so let me just see if I get the sort of the broader scenario. These things have been building for some time. The
yes.
networks have been created, and essentially, it feels like that the groundwork has been laid, and then we have something like the financial crisis, and we have waves of austerity, and so the context becomes ripe.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, and that's when this kicks in, right?
Right.
I mean, so it's like it's in the background, it's ongoing, and it's just sort of waiting for the right opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at Steve Bannon's career, and I think it's really instructive. I mean, now, Bannon is not the great man that he would like us to believe he is, but he's very consequential and important. I first came across Steve Bannon in 2010, when he was really kind of the chief propagandist for the Tea Party movement, you know, and he was not a frontline face of the movement, but he'd been working behind the scenes making propaganda for that movement for a very, very long time. This project just continues, and now we see him running around Europe organizing the far-right parties of Europe, consulting for them. We don't know who's paying him.
I mean, is he doing okay? The last interview I saw with him, he was cornered, I guess, by, I can't remember exactly who it was, but they questioned, he was claiming he was talking to, I think, like the Italian fascists or something.
Yes.
And the host said, well, I think it was Axios. It was on that Axios thing where they asked him, well, we spoke to that guy, and he said, you've barely been around. I mean, they said, we've spoken to that guy, and he says that he hasn't seen much of you.
Ah.
But it's hard to know, isn't it?
Well, I would, so here's something that I came across, right? I was in Brussels during the run-up to the campaign for the European Union parliamentary elections. Bannon set up shop in Paris, customarily in a 5-star hotel. He only stays in 5-star hotels. He only travels by private plane, where he caused some consternation to Marine Le Pen, who heads the far-right party in France, because what he wanted to do, what he was sort of advancing himself as the Svengali of these far-right parties that were all vying for spots in the European Union Parliament. And so at the same time, she needed to distance herself from him, just as Salvini would need to distance himself from Bannon, because these are nationalists, right? Their whole shtick is that, you know, they are Italy for Italians, France for the French. To have some American gurus appear to be, you know, bigfooting and guiding their campaigns would not reflect well on them. So it is difficult to know exactly where Bannon sits with them. However, I will say this, and that is, while Bannon was in Paris, several deputies of Marine Le Pen's party paid, you know, social calls on him. And, you know, he's he understands the data analytics. He understands messaging. So is he just having friendly, how's your wife, how's your kids kind of combos? Or?
Right.
I kind of doubt it.
Me too. He doesn't seem like that type of guy who cares.
And he seems to have just his unlimited cash flow. And we know he's, you know, a wealthy-ish guy, right? He's but that wealthy, I don't know.
Well, so what, I mean, So you're tracking this stuff.
Right.
And to a large extent, people have not been paying enough attention. But in the parallel universe where people were paying more attention, like what do you do?
Ah, this is always the question, right? And this is, I think we can loop this around domestically too. How I'm sensing a sort of, I mean, it's great to be at Netroots where it's positive and we've got energy growing. However, you know, it's difficult to,
Oh, excuse me one second. Please, can you just leave the chair and not sit there? I'm sorry. Some folks don't realize you're in the middle. It's a little bit distracting.
It's live radio,
yeah,
Sam.
I understand. Okay.
But it's truly difficult to...
I'm sorry. Will you pull in that chair? Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry. Can you repeat?
Okay.
Can you repeat?
Yeah. No. So the question is like, what do we do about it?
What can we do? Right. Right. And so, you know, we're here at Netroots where the energy is very positive, but out there in the country, you can feel kind of a sense of paralysis in general, given our domestic politics, and I think also in terms of the global situation to those who are in the know, right? Because we kind of don't know what to do right now. We're not in the streets, all of that. But what I would say is we need to really start thinking about what we want to say. What do we have to say to people who feel powerless? What do we have to say to them? Can we gather people together through the use of great memes? I mean, the right is running circles around us with in the digital space. Can we create platforms of our own? We need to be super creative. And I know people want an answer now, but if we don't build infrastructure, if we keep moving from election to election without building infrastructure of these types, of real organically grown creative shops, that's really what we need to do. We need to be gathering people to educate them about the threat. And we need to scare people because fear is what works.
Well, who's the we in this scenario? Like, I mean, is this an institutional project? Is this, do we need more people to be joining the DSA? Where does this, when we say we, like,
right,
who are we talking about?
Okay, so I would say all of it, right? And I know that's kind of too easy an answer. Yes, we do need institutional players. We really do. And if you're a social democrat, join the DSA, sure. And they're a good activist organization. However, I also think that people can use their own individual agency to create things because of the social media platforms available to us to distribute it. In other words, so I keep talking about the word propaganda. One of the reasons I know as much as I do about Bannon, and I hardly know the whole story, is that I've always been fascinated by him as a propagandist. And when I discuss him, I often talk about his work as a propagandist because he was very talented as a propagandist. We have a lot of creative people on our side. We need to... Sometimes individual agency is what we need. It would be great if some of the institutional players would help that along.
Right.
You know, help that along. Grant some money to some artists. Grant some money to other creative people, you know, that kind of thing. And get some stuff going. But it has to also, it has to come from both places. And if it doesn't come up from the grassroots, it always feels canned.
Someone was just telling me that at that authoritarian panel, I think, that the idea that propaganda is a value-neutral term,
yes,
came up.
I advanced that idea, and you know, I believe
yeah,
that.
Let's talk about that, because yeah. I have, since the beginning that I was on Air America, I would say, when people ask me, what's your job? And
right.
I was like, I'm an aspiring propagandist.
Yes.
And people were aghast at that. And I said, look, like, will you please just explain that concept? Because, I've been told that the left can't do propaganda, like, literally can't do it. Like, it's not possible.
That's ridiculous.
For the left to do it because propaganda is necessarily deceitful.
You don't have a movement without propaganda.
Right. Well, just explain to people what propaganda is.
So propaganda is nothing more than having a point of view encapsulated in a message. Now, it doesn't mean you lie. A lot of propaganda is lies. But it doesn't have to be.
Right.
You can tell the truth through the lens of your experience and do it creatively. Do it on a radio program. Do it in a podcast. Do it in a sign that you imagine being. You can create a protest if you create the propaganda for it. We always think that's putting the cart before the horse. Create the art, then make the movement around the art.
Right. Well, Adele Stan, if people want to read more of your work, where would they go?
Rightwingwatch.org. We're a project of People for the American Way. And I also have a column at the American Prospect, prospect.org, where I write a lot about these issues as well.
Great. Adele Stan, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much
for
having me, Sam.
All right, folks. We are going to cut to a pre-taped interview. Right, Matt? You look like... Okay. You have a look on your face of like, I don't know, maybe it's when you look into the Skype, you look terrified. But we're going to play an interview I did just about an hour ago with Winnie Wong and Brianna Joy Gray. She nailed me. I called her Greyjoy.
Yeah, but she called it the Minority Report in the other interview.
We ended up both copping to that in the interview. So we dispensed with that. It was a little tit for tat. It was, you know, it was like a brushback pitch.
It was the
you're gonna hit my batter who hit the home run. I'm gonna throw at somebody's head. That's how it basically happens.
Push him off the plate a little bit.
Exactly.
Who is taking the chair, Sam? That's what everybody wants to know.
Well, no, it was a guy, and he's a nice guy, and he was here before.
Don't take that chair.
Well,
I'm broadcasting.
No, it's not. It's not that he was taking the chair.
He was sitting on the chair.
We couldn't hear each other because I don't have headphones for the guests, and he was talking to Brendan.
I see.
Right in front of the camera, and sometimes it's like this sort of. There are people at conferences where I get it. Like, you just see a dude sitting at a booth, and you're like, okay, I can walk up to that guy, and what's the big deal? He's talking into a microphone, but it can't be anything that's that relevant. And they just start talking to you. And it's, you know, they do it with the nicest of intentions, but it's like... This is not a natural state for me. I don't walk around
really?
With a microphone.
I could
and just,
actually see you addressing your kids through
It's
that.
Not inconceivable
I
that I would
like,
do something like that.
Good morning.
But, right, exactly.
We have here's what's for breakfast, and here's what we're doing later. And I just love that, though. Has anyone
seen my socks?
Yeah,
has
yeah, right, right, right. Exactly, right.
Okay, all right. Well,
the agita was real. It was good.
No, yes. I'm going to cop to the audience.
Okay, thank you.
4 or 5 hours of sleep last night.
Indeed.
Brendan, was, like, literally following me around going, chug, 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 chug,
wow.
All last night. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so
but I, does New
that's
Jersey...
That's what you're paying for.
Does New Jersey Jeeves realize that when he does that, he's causing himself problems the next day?
He called you New Jersey Jeeves. So I drank a little bit, and of course, what Netroots is, and I think it's like this for a lot of people, but it's just like you go around and you meet other people who have just as passionate opinions about politics as you do, and you're in a bar, and you just keep drinking and yelling at each other about politics.
Oh, wow.
And, but I met... A great candidate who's going to be taking on Lowy in the New York 17th.
Oh, Lowy, that's a big one.
Yes, and this guy.
That's great.
Very, very impressive guy.
So we've got a whole set of candidates now.
Oh, sorry, I just lost that.
Because we have a really impressive guy taking on Elliot as well.
Yep, and his name is Mondaire Jones. And just, you know, we're in the bar. He's, you know, he's coming around because he wants to meet these activists. And his policies are all aligned. And he's just... it's interesting to hear the dynamics of this. I met a couple of members. Apparently, the Philadelphia City Council only allows for five members of any given party to sit on the council. And in the past, it's been Democrats, five, Republicans, two. And the Working Families Party is saying, like, well, guess what? The Republicans don't have to have those two other seats. And so they're going to try and make it five Democrats, two Working Families Party members
nice.
On the City Council of Philadelphia.
I like
meet people who are working with Krasner, the DA here. We're trying to get him on the show.
Yeah, that would be really good to get Krasner.
I mean, it's just, it really
I actually
is...
thought the first guest, I liked Adele. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, no,
I'd like
she's.
To hear from her more.
Yes, she's been around for a long time coming to this conference, and I've caught up with her, but we should have her on more. But
where is Eskow? You're right next to Eskow. Where is he?
Yeah, no, he's coming around. Like, I'm going to do some pre-tapes with some people, and that's what I'm going to do this afternoon. This afternoon, we're also going to be doing Adam Green from PCCC, and I last night at the bar came up with an idea of, like, we should have a panel, an impromptu panel at Netroots that we're going to do right here at this table. And I'm going to record and try to figure out how to make it hearable for all the reporters that Adam Green is going to get here. But we're going to be doing a panel with a couple other folks. I'm not exactly sure who he's gotten. I think right now, tentatively, it is Amy Allison and Alexander Rojas. And we're going to run an interview I did with Alexander Rojas in a bit on this program. She's the executive director of Justice Democrats. Amy Allison, I think, is head of She the People. And the panel is going to be a conversation on really the question, is Joe Biden the riskiest candidate in the Democratic field?
So all of a sudden we can talk about electability, you little prick.
Well, I'm just moderating.
I see.
I'm moderating. So.
Nice.
But all right, let's run this interview with Bree Joy Gray and Winnie Wong. They are both members of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Let's run that now.
We are back. Sam Cedar, our continuing coverage of Netroots Nation 2019. With me now, two top officials in the Bernie Sanders campaign, Brianna Greyjoy. She's the National Press Secretary. Winnie Wong, a senior political advisor. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Winnie, let's start with you. What is at this point in the campaign, what do you perceive as the single greatest challenge that that Bernie Sanders has?
I don't think we really have very many challenges at all. To be honest, I think we are building out a very strong organization, and we are focused on the issues, and we know that Donald Trump must be defeated, and I think that that is what the senator and the team is singularly focused on, you know, with just sort of advancing every day with that knowledge that we have to defeat Donald Trump, that this isn't really up for debate. And so all of our energy and all of our resources are devoted to that end goal.
I think when you have a movement building project like the one we are aiming to create, the enemy is often less often other candidates. The challenges aren't, defeating other candidates or, just anything, any other individuals, insofar as they are defeating the structural impediments that have always kept people from forming the broad-based coalition that is required to actually wrest power away from the powers that be, the 1%, the oligarchy. You see Bernie Sanders recently launched on his website a list of people who have called him out as the only political candidate that they are against. Oh, any of the Democrats could win, but not Bernie Sanders. And I don't know if you remember in his Democratic Socialism speech about a month ago, he quoted, did that FDR quote where he says, "I welcome their hatred." And he genuinely welcomes the hatred of people who have been thwarting the needs and the ability for the American people to live their lives with dignity and equality. And I think that those people, those powers that be who have invested millions and millions of dollars in spreading misinformation about Medicare for All and a lot of these other programs that stand to benefit the American people so extraordinarily, that's the challenge. That's the ongoing challenge. And that's the challenge for everybody who is a part of this movement toward broader equality in this country.
Okay. She's saying we have to get money out of politics.
Well, yeah, but other candidates, folks working for other candidates, would not focus around the building of a movement as a source of their challenge. And I guess because I think it's a different perspective on how you run for president. I mean, I don't have a huge breadth of political knowledge, but a decent amount. And the articulation of trying to build a movement as the primary sort of focus of a presidential campaign is fairly unique, I think, at least as a conscious effort. I mean, can you look back in history and sort of track? I mean, if you guys, because Sanders going and using his email list for on immigration, completely distinct from what you would necessarily do as a campaign. If that was your singular focus. So I guess what I'm asking is, when you look back as a senior political advisor, are there models for this, for building a movement that, for running a campaign and building a movement simultaneously in such a self-conscious way?
I mean, I think when we look back in history and we look back at two different periods in history, we'll say the 60s civil rights movement and then the movement in the 30s to defeat fascism. And we look back and we see what they did wrong and what they did right, which I think a lot of us inside do look back on those periods of social movement, robust social movements, and it helps inform our work now. We see that both movements were movements of, were popular movements of people coming together to resist a common enemy. So that's happening now, but they didn't have the internet.
Right.
And they didn't have like different forms of different platforms where we could distribute our message. And so I think, you know, it's different now. If you think about the 60s and you think about how political revolutionaries or activists like Fred Hampton or other activists were really trying to electoralize their work on the streets, and how quickly the state tamped that down. And we try to move that into today's context, we see that like it's impossible to do that now because there's so many political revolutionaries and our principal is a political revolutionary. So it's important to actually take this moment to build power politically.
Yeah, I do think to your point that is there an example of the movement coming from inside the house in the
right.
way that this campaign is aspiring to do? I can't think of an example of that, but that what is true is that every time we've seen a significant social advancement in this country, a revolutionary moment, it has come not willingly at the behest of individual political leaders, but because of the pressure of an outside movement. So a movement has always been essential to actual change being affected. And there's this story, I believe it was LBJ, who had a meeting with civil rights leaders and said, okay, I agree with you, but now go out there and make me do it. Because without the political pressure, you know, it has historically provided some cover for politicians who might otherwise take political heat for doing what even they believed was right. And politicians who did not necessarily agree with the movement would go ahead and advance goals
right.
if they were pressured to do so. I mean, at the end of the day, it was Nixon who signed the EPA, right? So I think that this campaign, because it is internalizing the movement structure, stands to perhaps do even more than any of these other politicians and any of these other crucial political moments have been able to do, because they're not relying solely. They don't need to be convinced, and it is willing. We are willing to do the right thing, even when it's not politically expedient. You know, the reason I wasn't even planning to come to Netroots, the reason that I'm here today, is because I came yesterday to help protest the closure of Hahnemann University Hospital, right? And this is part and parcel what the campaign wants to do. Like, regardless of whether or not Bernie Sanders gets in office, and we believe he will be, the movement making doesn't start or stop when he enters the White House. He doesn't decide to go and stand with Walmart workers or Amazon workers or Disney workers based on a political cycle. He's been doing that since before. He's right. been doing that his entire life, to be honest.
Right. And I mean, there's an argument that I think some political watchers would say, like, well, it's a diversion of resources. Like, well, I mean, it seems that it's not an irrational argument to say. Most campaigns would say, we're going to put all our resources into getting elected,
right.
and then we'll worry about that other stuff.
But we think people are one of our biggest resources. You know, it's I think it was an AOC quote, now appropriate by Ryan Grimm for his book. You know, they got money, we got people.
Right.
And all of those people who see us standing in solidarity understand that the mission isn't, I need to get in office because I think I'm the special snowflake that needs to run the country. It's, these are my goals, and my interest in being in office is only to advance these goals, which I shared with you and have shown solidarity for decades, frankly, in the case of Bernie Sanders.
When I think about the Hahnemann protest yesterday that we showed up for, I think about how this particular conference could have actually given more support to the protest. It could have been, you know, hundreds of people showed up, mostly because labor unions and Senator Sanders turned out bodies from his email list. And if the conference had actually said, you know what, we're going to actually, like, send folks over, it could have been 3,000 people. I mean,
right.
it's a fight that, like, we have to show up to. And it's a fight that people need to know about, because if this is allowed to happen in Philadelphia, it will happen in every major city.
Right.
Right.
Right. We cannot let a hospital that serves underserved people close. There are maternity wards. The maternity ward is closing. There are like 48 women who are pregnant and who are ready to give birth in that hospital right now. There are patients with terminal cancer who are receiving treatment right now. There are elderly people with diabetes who are receiving treatment right now. They cannot go anywhere. They would have to take 3 buses in their infirm condition to even receive treatment.
Right.
So what this is actually a death sentence. And so when the senator sees that this is a fight of humanity,
yeah.
of basic humanity, he's going to show up, and he's going to move his staff and the resources at his disposal, i.e. his email list, to turn people out to show up for the fight. And I think he'll continue to do that. And that's like a defining characteristic or a defining it's the defining feature of
it's
our
why right. I'm here. It makes me proud. Yeah. It makes me genuinely proud to be a member of this campaign.
And I should just say, for folks who didn't hear my interview yesterday with David Dayan about this, Hahnemann is sort of a proof of concept for a private equity to come in, buy the hospital, separate the hospital from the land, bankrupt the hospital, keep the land, sell the land, develop it for condos. This can happen, like you say, urban centers around the country. This particular private equity outfit owns half a dozen other hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Howard University Hospital in D.C.
In D.C., L.A., a couple other cities. And then, of course, it doesn't have to end with hospitals. You can go to any sort of massive institutions that are, serving folks in the urban cities. All right. Well, so with that said, this notion of building the movement, simultaneously running for a campaign, how does it affect your strategy when there are other candidates who because they rely on big donors, they've got to prove certain things early on in the campaign to maintain that support, where Bernie Sanders relies primarily on small donors, who have not maxed out in this month, a year and a half out from the thing. They presumably, you know how many of those people have already signed up to give on a monthly basis. So the campaign, in some respects, doesn't have the same pressure. How does that change the strategy? As opposed to, say, someone like who's gone all in on Iowa, if we don't win in Iowa, we're done. There's multiple candidates, I think, who probably are, you know, that's their calculation. I don't think that's Bernie Sanders' calculation, because he has the resources to go, and much of the movement building, theoretically, right, will pay off later. This is not a short-term investment. So how does that affect the strategy in terms of, like, what Sanders feels he needs to do, or what the campaign feels it needs to be now, 6 months from now, et cetera?
I mean, I think we have to reach voters. Like, this is the strategy. You win when you speak to people at the doors. You win when you communicate a message that is authentic and speaks to the values of working families across the country. I mean, it's very basic.
What
we
has
have
been
to
that,
reach
that,
the maximum.
How
amount
many
of,
voters do you think you've touched at this point? I mean, how many?
You know, I don't actually know. I know that we've certainly sent a lot of text messages, multiple millions of text messages. We know that 99% of our small dollar donors are eligible to donate again, and they will likely be able to continue to donate. So if you look at, like, the average donation, and you repeat that average donation for the next two quarters, you can see that we're probably on track to match what we've made in Q2, and so that's great. And we are. Look, we have a great campaign manager. We have a great team. We have a very hardworking principal. He's very hardworking. He campaigns tirelessly across the country. He also is a senator who shows up for votes and organizes inside his office and writes endless op-eds. So he's a busy guy, and we are building a team culture. And I think that's all I can say. We're going to reach as many voters as we possibly can, and we're going to stay focused on running a positive campaign where we contrast our position to the positions of our competitors.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that any other campaign can say they have a million person strong volunteer army, especially at this point in the process, or who can say that in quarter two they got nearly a million individual donations, right?
Right.
Like, yeah. That's extraordinary. That's a genuine
reflection.
And that's
not something
reflection.
That you necessarily see the
I
benefits of until
$3.
People actually go to the polls.
Right. Well, those that's much more reflective of actual voters who have a true investment in the campaign so early, mind you, than, you know, if another candidate might be the highest earning candidate this quarter. But if you're earning $24 million, raising $24 million, and you have a 4% approval rating, you know, it really begs the question, who is funding this campaign?
Right.
Who is actually asking for this campaign? And is this campaign going to ultimately be responsible to the will of the people? If Bernie Sanders no longer is compelling to the millions of small donors that are giving to him, well, they'll stop donating.
Right.
He has to be beholden to the masses in a way that other people aren't. And that's why you see using his organizing list to rally people to various causes as not a waste of time. But of course, ethically, intrinsically, it's valuable. But also, it's very much a core to continuing to keep people inspired that this is the mission, and that the mission isn't going to change regardless of whether or not he is in the White House or not.
Well, Breonna Joy-Gray, National Press Secretary.
It's actually Breonna Joy-Gray. A lot of people do the Westeros thing with me. The Game of Thrones it. No worries. We're not
the
first.
Greyjoy.
Yeah.
Oh, the people from the Iron
Man.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, Yara's pretty
Sader,
great.
I'm Sam Sader, and this is the Minority Report. Those are the things I get. Sader and Minority Report. I'm sorry.
I did it to you on our podcast the other day. So.
Back at you.
Even
Got
Stevens.
You back. Got you back.
What's for lunch?
Breonna Joy-Gray, National Press Secretary. Winnie Wong, Senior Political Advisor for Bernie Sanders. Thank you both for talking to us today.
It's my pleasure.
I don't care.
There you go. What's that, Glenn Beck? Why am I hearing Glenn Beck? Sending Glenn Beck back to me.
It's just the rest of my library.
Oh, I heard. Why do you have a library of Glenn Beck?
I don't know. We can't get into it right now.
Okay. That's probably best that we don't. Continuing our coverage here at the Netroots Nation 2019. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project. Is that right? Is that what it's called?
That is exactly what it's called.
Okay. And this is bear with me here. I think will you say something?
Sure. Revolving Door Project at his fifth Netroots Nation.
Gosh, I don't know what's going on here. I'm trying to try it one more time.
This is Jeff Hauser here at his fifth Netroots Nation.
Okay, there we go. Sorry. This is your fifth?
Yeah.
But you haven't been here in about 7 years.
Yes, I went to the second, the fourth, and then a couple more early in the decade, and then my son was born.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So there's really no story as to why you're back.
No. It's not like I've said the Netroots, they're slimy, they're dirty, they're very lefty. I can't hang out with them. That's still my type of people.
Okay. Now, you work on corruption in government. Must be a very slow time for you.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that Donald Trump has brought to government is just we got to be by the books. We can't... We can't even push against the limits of the law. We have to respect the truest instincts of the law and the best intentions.
And your pedigree is that you were in the DOJ, is that right?
Yeah, I started out after law school. I accepted a job when I thought that the person who won the election would be inaugurated. I accepted a job in 2000. Unfortunately, that meant I started in 2001 in the antitrust division under John Ashcroft and George W. Bush.
And did you let the mighty eagle soar?
I did not. My karaoke voice is bad for all sorts of songs, but especially John Ashcroft originals.
Okay. So so when you see this, where do you start with something like this? I mean, when you look at what's going on with the Trump administration, is there a hierarchy of... because I know you have broken stories about the shadow sort of cabinet secretaries and the way that they were staffing places. And that's still ongoing, in fact.
Absolutely.
All right, just explain what that project is. And then I just want to ask how you prioritize. Do you prioritize? Like, what's the most destructive? What's the most destructive in terms of its durability? I mean, how do you manage all that stuff? And then I guess we'll talk about the shadow.
Sure. They're connected in that I got a tip in January of 2017 that Trump was preparing a launching pad of his beachhead who were going to go into the government, not as Senate-confirmed officials and not as well-meaning members of civil society, but rather basically former lobbyists. We're going to go spend a few months setting up the Trump administration on behalf of their both past and future clients. And they were going to do so at a scale that had never before been seen. And they were bringing in literally the worst people. And why that was so important is not just that it kind of undermines the Constitution's appointments clause and our general sense that the executive branch should be run by Senate-confirmed officials, but also because they were doing so on behalf of America's worst corporate interests. And to me, the Trump scandals that matter the most are where you can connect Trump's criminality or scandalous behavior to issues where rich jerks are making money and the rest of us are getting hurt. So when the intersection of kitchen table issues and of Trump scandals. Now, all of the Trump scandals matter. All of them are worth attention. I don't disparage any of them. But to me, the ones that are most glaringly crying out for attention are those where Trump is threatening the well-meaning of American people.
So, in other words, it's got to be both the corruption with policy implications.
Sure. If you look at the Environmental Protection Agency, which is only protecting polluters at this point, there are, statistically speaking, hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are going to die on the more traditional types of pollution, you know, dirty water, dirty air, and then obviously we have a climate catastrophe in the making, which is being exacerbated. If you look at the education department, where so many families are burdened by student debt from slimy for-profit colleges, and Betsy DeVos hired past for-profit college lobbyists to run her administration, and then they are beginning to revolve out and go back into that industry, an industry that was almost dead by the end of the Obama administration, but has been revitalized under Betsy DeVos's extremely corrupt reign at the Education Department. Now, this is going on, obviously, for Wall Street, at Treasury, et cetera, rinse and repeat.
I would just got to say about the for-profit colleges. If you take a look, and I know my audience has said this, and you probably know this as well, but it bears repeating. If you take a look at a graph of a fund of for-profit college stocks, it literally goes like this. It's going down a trajectory like this to November 7th, 2016, and then it shoots up almost directly straight up and just continues to climb. I mean, the day Donald Trump was elected, those stocks went through the roof, and they all knew what was coming.
And yeah, and Betsy DeVos was a beneficiary, as she owned a lot of those stocks on November 6th, 2016. And her unwinding of those financial ties has been incomplete, to say the least.
Yes. So for you, it's that intersection of policy and corruption, and that has the most durability. What can be done? Well, we're going to end up talking about what's going on with Pelosi, and we're talking about oversight. And I guess to the extent of, like, what is the first thing that could be done, it starts with oversight, right? I mean, it's like, you can't. Jeff Hauser can write articles about it and could point it out, but that's the end of the story, right? If Congress doesn't do its job.
Nancy Pelosi, in my estimation, has to start looking at the power she has over the House of Representatives, not as a potential liability, but as an asset, that she has the ability to cause fights with Trump on the most advantageous landscape available. The fact that there'd been no effort by Congress to look into Alex Acosta until Trump let him out, pushed him out, whatever happened today, that's ridiculous. Like, why was Trump quicker to respond to Alex Acosta than the Education and Labor Committee of the House of Representatives? Pelosi needs to start looking at oversight as a set of opportunities to drive a conversation where she can focus on Trump's worst behavior and the behavior that most impacts the American people. So
And that's presuming that you don't even stop the corruption, right? Like, it's a benefit. Obviously, stopping the corruption in some way is beneficial, but there's political value in all of this. I mean, even beyond, like, it seems to be exponential.
Yeah, I mean, there's this view you'll hear from Pelosi defenders that, well, we don't want to do anything like Benghazi. So let's look at Benghazi for a second. A, it's not really a scandal. B, it directly led to the awareness of Hillary Clinton's email server and then everything that happened with James Comey, which was obviously necessary to Trump's marginal electoral college victory. Jim Comey was necessary for that victory. Jim Comey intervened in the election only because of the Benghazi inquiry. So a non-scandal, if investigated thoroughly, can potentially tip an entire presidential election. What could investigations into actual scandals have as their political outcome? So yes, I, as a good government anti-corruption person, want to see the corruption looked at for substantive reasons. But the political analysis that is a potential liability for Democrats rather than a potentially strong course of action is beyond me.
And it not only has impact on the political fortunes of Donald Trump in 2020, but then you're putting the entire Republican Party in a position where they have to actually actively either ignore an obvious scandal, or they have to do something about it.
I mean, if you are Joni Ernst from Iowa, if you are Martha McSally from Arizona, there are all sorts of behaviors by Trump that you believe that you can distance yourself from because you are not as profane as Donald Trump. You don't violate as many norms as Donald Trump. And you are going to try to use, in both of their cases, they are, you know, serve the country in the military. They have bios that have potential strengths. And so if you're Mitch McConnell and you want to hold on to the Senate, you are trying to protect people like Joni Ernst and Martha McSally from the popular things that a Nancy Pelosi could do. If Nancy Pelosi were to start impeaching not just Trump, but if she were just to start on the cabinet officials who've committed crimes and are very hard to defend, you could start creating pressure on Ernst and McSally and many others to either vote with Trump and risk losing the center, or vote against Trump and risk losing their base. That is a choice they do not want to face, and that is a choice that Nancy Pelosi should be forcing upon Senate Republicans.
It's, I mean, this is not sort of, you know, this is not 12-dimensional chess. This is sort of like basic wedge issue politics, right? Like, you need to separate the senators who are vulnerable from Donald Trump. And they don't want to. They just want to sort of like be in this miasma and sort of make it unclear where they are at any given point. And Nancy Pelosi, it seems to me, and Chuck Schumer is equally, maybe even more so in some respects, responsible for this. I mean, two weeks ago, I had Alex Breen on and we were talking about this. And he has a theory that Pelosi's not going forward with impeachment because, not unlike we just saw with the funding for the Customs and Border Patrol bill, she's not convinced that, never mind they're going to lose in the Senate, everybody knows that, but she's not convinced that they're not going to lose half of the Democratic caucus in the Senate in an impeachment vote. And of course, it becomes a liability, right, for Democrats in the House.
I mean, I could imagine that being a genuine concern. I'm sure it is. And I guess that is definitely something that Pelosi has to take into account. But honestly, between Pelosi and Schumer, opposition is supposed to be easier in terms of maintaining unity. Like, and the funny thing is, governing is harder. And so Pelosi's great accomplishment in her career is pushing the Affordable Care Act over the finish line when other people lost their nerve. And that was hard because they were trying to officially push a major change in American policy. And that is difficult. And she actually managed to accomplish it then. Now it's actually a lot easier because you have a repugnant president who has not at one time in his presidency been a popular figure. Opposition is supposed to be much easier to maintain unity. Like, we all have disagreements about Medicare buy-in versus single payer and all. Like, those, I understand, those are going to be complicated issues down the line. But you should be able to maintain, kids in cages is wrong. Like, that is the type of thing we should be able to stay united. And so, yes, as between Schumer and Pelosi, who's accorded what percentage of the blame, I don't know. But between them, they need to do better.
Right. Between them, it's about 100%.
Yes.
And the idea that you're hesitating to criticize and investigate the guy who gave a sweetheart deal to a child sex trafficker is like, well, I don't understand. Like, do you know anybody who even knows, like, has an idea as to like what's going through their mind? Like, I mean, there are theories that are bound, but I keep like asking people, like hoping to run into the one person who's like, yeah, I know, but this is the theory, and nobody can even give me a theory.
I think that Democrats, and there are pluses and minuses to this, but they rely on seniority to determine who is the committee chair. And you have a lot of people who have spent a long time in the minority who have not been a chair before, and they all dreamed of pushing their legislative agenda as a chair. And they did not dream of doing oversight. And it is unfortunate that they don't consider oversight to be one of their key avenues. But they've essentially begun to outsource all oversight to the House Oversight Committee. There's one specific committee that has oversight over anything it wants, and then 19 committees that have jurisdiction on specific issues and oversight within those issues. And Elijah Cummings is a very busy man. He chairs the House Oversight Committee. He is doing the best he can. He has way too much to look at. But you need the subject matter expertise of House Ways and Means on taxes. You need the House Transportation Committee to look into Boeing and how planes are falling out of the air. You need the House Agriculture Committee to look into how the Secretary of Agriculture is doing all sorts of corrupt business, allowing big agriculture to take advantage of America's farmers, et cetera, et cetera. And they just don't seem to see their job that way. Part of it's cultural. Part of it is a failure of individuals. But ultimately, Nancy Pelosi sets the agenda for the entire caucus, and she's the easiest person to hold responsible.
Okay. So aside from doing podcasts and getting really mad about it, what could folks at like this conference do?
I think they have to start raising expectations with activists about Congress. They have to start talking about how oversight is really critical to what Congress does and start having higher expectations. I mean, there are potential and current primary challengers to some of the committee chairs. And I don't do electoral work anymore, and I can't recommend anything about that. But it strikes me that if key members of the congressional leadership, actually any member of Congress in the Democratic majority, if they started hearing from their constituents that constituent wants to see more oversight, that would get heard. It doesn't take that much effort to make Democrats complain to Pelosi, like, look, I'm getting all these phone calls, like, they're saying, even if you won't do impeachment, let's do some other oversight. I think that information would be...
You know, it's interesting because I've heard people, like, you know, with Nadler, for instance, he's getting a challenger. And I'm not even convinced, based on a voting record, that the challenger is necessarily even to the left of Nadler. But if it is communicated that, like, look, this challenge is coming because you're not doing proper oversight, that gives him some leverage with Pelosi, doesn't it? I mean, where he's got to go to her and say, like, yeah, okay, you can worry a hypothetical about these, frontline Democrats, but I got something real in my backyard, and I got to deal with it. So I got to move forward with you or without you.
And Nadler has strategically put out through the press the news that, like, he supports impeachment. Like, he is not the primary person responsible. That doesn't mean a primary serves no purpose. In fact, for the exact reason you've identified, it's very important in making this pressure felt by Pelosi. But, I mean, Richard Neal may or may not have a primary challenger. Pete DeFazio has a challenger who's at this conference right now. There are, and I think there are other leading members of the Democratic Party who either have challengers or have people contemplating a challenge right now. And I think it's a moment to say that it's not about how you vote only. It's whether or not you're a high-energy member of Congress. We want high-energy members of Congress who are willing to just do whatever they can, who feel the same urgency that activists do. There are activists here who are doing pro-immigrant activism at this conference. They feel an urgency. They're not paid to do it. It's not their career. They're doing it because they're activists. You'd like to think that elected members of Congress would feel no less urgency than activists feel about all the horrors that are being perpetrated by the Trump administration.
Jeff Hauser, people want to read your work, support your work, where would they go?
Just Google the Revolving Door Project newsletter. You can sign up, and that's every 2 weeks we put out a compendium of the work that we're working on and the issues we're following.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
All right. All right, folks. Now we're going to go to a previously recorded interview, another one, with Alexandra Rojas. She is the executive director of Justice Democrats. And I spoke to her this morning, this afternoon, yesterday afternoon, sometime in the last 24 hours. And Matt, you ready to run that? Okay, let's run that now. So continuing our coverage at Netroots Nation 2019, I'm here with Alexandra Rojas. She is the executive director of Justice Democrats. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
All right. So I think by now my audience has a pretty good sense of what the Justice Democrats are, but give us the sort of the elevator pitch for those who might not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're trying to transform the Democratic Party to actually fight for its voters and not just corporate donors. For us, that means engaging in competitive primary elections to recruit a new generation of leadership and build a mission-driven team of Justice Democrats in the House that are actually going to present solutions as big as the problems that we're facing that match the scale, scope, and urgency of them. And I think that we can see, you know, we acknowledge that the same leadership that has sort of gotten us into this mess aren't going to be the ones to get us out of it. And so we're trying to merge, I think, electoral organizing with social movement building. And you can see the sort of case study of that work with candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being able to, once elected, team up with organizations like us in Sunrise to push issues like a Green New Deal into the national conversation.
And in the last election, I think there were 65 candidates that, got the...
Over 70.
Mm-hmm. Who got the endorsement from Justice Democrats. In the end, not a huge number of those won their elections, but obviously... some fairly prominent wins. You mentioned AOC, and I think most people accept the premise that to the extent that there's any energy left in the Democratic Party, it's coming out of folks like AOC. All right, so we need to talk about, I want to get into sort of more theory of change questions in a bit, but let's just deal with what sort of right in the front burner, I think, is this. There's a lot of friction right now within the Democratic caucus, and Nancy Pelosi seems to have a strategy. Do you have a sense of what that strategy is?
No, I don't. I think that wielding power for the sake of power and not using it to do the most benefit for the people of the America, and you're putting politics before it, doesn't make sense to have it in the first place. And so I think that, you know, for us, the strategy that we feel is the one that is exciting to voters is by going straight to them, carrying our message straight to them. And that's presenting solutions that are actually matching the problems that are facing them every day. And so I hope Nancy Pelosi chooses to do that and focus on defeating Donald Trump and not singling out four members of Congress versus the Problem Solvers Caucus, which I think is causing her more trouble.
I mean, but you even from like even from her perspective, do you see what, like, I think they should start with impeachment hearings, but I can understand the sort of theory behind why you wouldn't. But I honestly can't, even based upon what her objectives are, understand what's going on. Do you
I would
guys
agree. No, I don't understand. Like I said, I don't understand it. I think leadership is operating from a place of courage and from strength and not just being afraid of what the Republicans are going to say or how politically it's going to do. I think at the end of the day, we have to do what's right for the American people and uphold, at least for members of Congress, have to uphold their constitutional responsibility to hold the president accountable.
Okay, so give me a sense of what... Justice Democrats... Presumably, the strategy is going to be an extension of what it was last time. You're going to go out and you're going to primary Democrats who are what? Like, I mean, what, when you sit on, presumably in some office with a big board, what are the criteria in which you start to look at what races you're going to
look
at?
Well, the first thing I will say is that we're not in this to be against anybody. We're in this to elect champions of the issues that we care about. So first off, I think, you know, what we're trying to do is something positive, which is transform, I think, the direction of this country to speed up the timescale that we need to tackle issues like climate change. But I think the way that we look at districts is part art, part science. That art part is what I just spoke to, which is that we're electing champions. And we believe that the foundation of our process that rests on a nomination form is because we need a Congress that's not majority white, that's not majority wealthy, and that reflects the diversity, not just of ethnicity, but of background of the American people, right? We have 330 million bright and amazing people that make up the most advanced society, economy, all of that stuff, right? That means that we can diversify Congress beyond just attorneys and wealthy people. The science part, to get to your point, is where we look at, positions within the Democratic Party. How long have they gone unchallenged? What are the demographic makeups of the district, both in terms of, you know, the makeup of the community there, but also, is it urban? Is it rural? Is that going to inform our field program? What is the ideological record of the incumbent? Someone like Henry Cuellar is going to go to the top of the list, right? But if we had done that for just Joe Crowley, he wouldn't have, right? But he has the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House, someone that when you talk to the people there has been absent, hadn't been challenged in a long time, and took a ton of corporate and Wall Street money. And so I think at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is bring out the best in Democrats. We personally believe that no incumbent is beholden to their seat. We only have so many resources. So this cycle, we're going to focus on 20 to 25, with the majority being against incumbent Democrats that we feel deserve to be challenged.
So, okay. So when you're making those calculations, the primary factor is going to be the behavior of those incumbents, and then if there's a couple of stars in a marginal seat, you go with the marginal. Then those are the ones.
No, I would flip it. I would say the number one thing is that we want to elect champions. So even if it's a district that seems really difficult, like AOC's, we're going to do it anyway because we need to support progressive grassroots insurgent challengers if we want to transform the party, not just from a, you know, win-lose perspective, but also to advance the issues that we care about. And we can see that just over the past 2 to 3 years, right, single payer is now asked at the presidential debate to be asked. So I think, like, either way, that's important. That's number one. I think number two is making sure that we have that we, you know, replace incumbents that are deeply out of touch with Democratic values, like Dan Lipinski, Henry Goyar, or those that aren't, you know, that are accepting corporate money and ruled by special interests.
So I asked Sean McKelvey this question. I know the Data for Progress, you guys do a lot of work together. What is the number, do you think, that progressives need to get to in the caucus to where they have the ability to sort of to basically take the problem solvers and sideline them? Like, you know, like, what's the critical mass? Do you have a sense of that, or is it, we'll know it when we get there?
So I'm also a co-founder of Brand New Congress. So I literally used to think we're going to repeal and replace and run 400 candidates. So I definitely used to think that, you know, we needed, you know, hundreds of Justice Democrats in there. But I think the reality is that we can see that it doesn't take that many to really expand not just the national conversation, but I think momentum for our movement, right, to continue to power it. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, these issues are really urgent, but we're going to have to build over time, to your point, right? So I think that where I used to think it was, you know, hundreds of Justice Democrats, I think if we build a caucus of 20 to 30 and we wield and they are putting their political ambitions to the side and they are focusing on what's right for the American people, even when it's uncomfortable, I think that we can see that the rest of the caucus will sign on. And you can see that with, you know, Green New Deal on day one had like over 80 co-sponsors. And when you look at the co-sponsorships, a lot of them are afraid of getting primary challenge. So I think that it's a number of strategies that we have to use to really pressure incumbents. But one of the best ways that we've seen to be able to do that and already have an impact is by just challenging them.
Yeah, McKelvey also added, and I have to say, like, it stuck with me because in all my time discussing the value of challenging incumbents, I hadn't really quite contemplated the idea of even challenging those who may not be in that column of a Cuellar,
yeah,
but to empower them to go to Nancy Pelosi and say, look, I'm going to get challenged here, so I need to do X, Y, and Z. Nadler, for instance, I need to subpoena, or I need to issue, you know, to get more information or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, when you guys are looking at this stuff, to what extent do you look at maybe looking at different districts around, putting aside for the moment as to what Democrats are not necessarily on board programmatically, but is there a second sort of look at things where you look at, if we had this type of geographic distribution of Justice Democrats, or if we had this type of demographic representation of certain demographic you know, Waukesha County, let's say. Like, do you contemplate that notion of there is a potential strategy that involves very specific districts around the country that would leverage a speaker or a majority leader more so than others? Or is that just overthinking things?
No, that's not overthinking it. I think that's exactly what we're doing. I think that we have to apply pressure and you know, build power. And I think, you know, in absent of being able to win hundreds of congressional seats, I think one of the only ways is by being able to choose races this time, right? I think last time we had a little bit of a shotgun method where we endorsed over 70. And we did that because we wanted to back progressive challengers and show that doesn't matter if you're running in Texas, the Democratic Party shouldn't be forgetting about you. And if we want to, you know, actually build power long term, it can't just be a transactional relationship with the community and thinking about, oh, win and lose. You have to make multi-cycle investments to see change, right? But I think this time where we have, you know, a $16.17 average contribution, I want to make sure that we're using our resources as strategically for the movement, but obviously to build power as possible. And I think one of the best ways to do that is by that part art, part science method, where we're building a narrative in a race. We're finding and recruiting candidates that are reflective of the communities that they're serving. And we're making sure that they are going to run unapologetically because they champion these issues. There's an intuitive, like their life experience is why they support these policies. And I think the people that we're going to be challenging, like Henry Cuellar, like Dan Lipinski, and the ones to come, are going to be that mix of champion, and also because those particular incumbents are halting progressive priorities. And if we want to pass legislation at the end of the day, they need to go.
What have there been instances where you have over the past year and a half, I guess, maybe since, you know, following the 2018 election, where you thought to yourself, wow, they're afraid of us? And like, who would that be, to the extent, I mean, have there been moments where you sort of became conscious of like, okay, now we're not necessarily that you need outside validation to say that you're legit, but that you got a sense of like, oh, this is how we're being perceived in the context of the establishment, let's say.
Well, I will say, and I'm really proud that we do not have an inside game beyond getting the champions that we have in there and making sure that they are, you know, have the support and doing the good work that they do. You know, our power does not come from DC insiders and the establishment. So that's first off. But I will say that, you know, I don't think anyone was expecting Jessica Cisneros to raise $150,000 in 48 hours.
Right.
And I think that people are taking this race seriously, establishment and not establishment. And I think even people within the sort of party establishment are exactly what's happening right now on the national stage with Pelosi attacking these four women of color who are championing what their constituents want, are really disappointed in that. They're not just sort of Bernie bros like myself. They are people that have been in the party for a long time that are disappointed with the leadership and the direction that this country is going. Because we got Donald Trump, right? For whatever reason, we couldn't stop him as a Democratic Party. 2016 was when I got politically activated, and I feel like it's my responsibility to try and do something about it and really believe that the same leadership that got us here isn't going to be the ones that get us out.
You weren't involved in politics at all before 2016?
I was a full, full-time student and full-time in the workforce. And that's why I think primary challenges are so important, because my entryway into politics was during a presidential primary. Bernie Sanders, you know, I couldn't afford to go to college like I had planned to when I moved out to California. I'm originally from Connecticut. But I, you know, heard this crazy old white guy from Vermont talking about these big solutions, and that, you know, we need millions of people to step up and demand change if we're going to do something. And I think, like, that's powerful. And there were tons of other young women of color like myself that stepped up. And we're not going away, even as much as Pelosi wants to push us out.
Why do you think that maybe this is outside your portfolio, but why do you think...
Just a heads up, I got to go soon.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Why do you think your generation has been able to be more effective, let's say, than my generation in churning things a little bit in the Democratic Party?
I don't know if it's a question of effectiveness, because when we look back at some of the biggest social movements of our past, which is our North Star, right? We look at, we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? That it's always been young people. The founding of this country, you know, as much as, you know, they probably wouldn't have liked people like me, were young people.
Right.
And so, you know, if we're going to sort of continue to pass the baton, I think that, you know, my generation is going to be the first that's worse off than their parents. I'm questioning whether or not I can have kids, because in 10 years, are we going to have a planet to live on? I grew up during the 2008 financial crisis and watching my parents struggle. I couldn't afford to go to college, and that's why I'm sitting here and had to create a full-time job for myself. So I think when you hear people like Joe Biden, for example, say, oh, millennials, you know, they're so privileged. He said that before. It's really hurtful. And when you see, the leadership of the Democratic Party, like Nancy Pelosi, slighting the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, some of the most diverse, the first two Muslim women ever elected to Congress. When millions of young people really, really feel a sense of urgency, not from a privileged place, but because we can't afford to do the things that we want to do, it's a privileged position for the Democratic Party to face. So I don't know if that means that we've got a big fight ahead of us, but I think for me, it's hard to see beyond the next 2 years of what's going to happen if we don't do something in 2020 to defeat Donald Trump and actually elect a Democrat that's going to go big and going to do what's scientifically mandated that needs to be done, to deal with climate change and implement something like a Green New Deal. Because we've done it before. That's the crazy part, right?
Right.
We've done this before, and we got to go back to our roots.
If someone wants to give $16 or $17...
JusticeDemocrats.com.
JusticeDemocrats.com. Alexander Rojas, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
It. Okay, folks, we're having a little bit of a problem with our video feed. We're going to stop our video feed and try and relaunch, and we will do so in just about 3 minutes. We'll be back. We've got a lot more guests for you, and we will continue with our coverage at Netroots Nation. All right, we're going to sign off, and we'll sign right back on. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We got our video fixed. Listen, folks, we had a problem earlier. Apparently, the video feed that we had for the interview with Bree Joy Gray and Winnie Wong did not go through. We put up a graphic, and apparently we put up a picture of the wrong Winnie Wong. We put up a picture of a woman named Winnie Wong, who's a lawyer in California and not the political advisor to Bernie Sanders. So we're going to repost that video, the first half of the video. We've taken it down. We're going to repost it. We have the actual video because we recorded it locally. It just didn't make it through our system, I guess. And I've already texted Winnie, apologized to her. We've apologized on Twitter. It was a mistake. It was a super sloppy mistake. Not hard to confirm, you know, who the picture belongs to, even if it has the same name. And we will not make that mistake again. But I want to apologize to people because I don't want to do that for any guest, for that matter. And although, I don't know, if folks want to find a random Adam Green picture and...
Can I actually make a request?
Adam, you're on camera. I just want you to know
people.
There
is a drummer for a band called the Moldy Peaches named Adam Green who takes
is
up the
true?
First 30 pages of Google if you type in Adam Green. He looks way cooler than me. So if you could actually post a picture of the drummer,
well,
that'd be
maybe
helpful.
We
it
will,
would not be a mistake. No apology needed.
We will do that for Adam Green. It's
fixing
special.
Editing. All right.
But, yeah, no, we apologize. It's just sloppy, sloppy work, and we will not do that again. Ryan Grimm's supposed to be here. We were going to do the three-way interview. Apparently, he's got better things to do. Will you text him? Tell him to come?
I'll text him, yeah. Actually, can I just say his phone number and everybody at home can text him?
No, that's
okay,
probably not good. Adam is the co-founder of the PCCC, the Progressive Campaign, I can never remember.
That's cool. It's Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
Yeah, the Progressive Campaign Change Committee is actually a lawyer in California, so please don't get us confused. A little way different.
Also, boldprogressives.org.
Boldprogressives.org.
See, I remember your URL, but yeah. Not, I remember the important stuff.
Yeah, we did the masterstroke of having three brands. We're the PCCC. We're the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. We're boldprogressive.org. Just to
well,
confuse lots of people.
It confuses people. Yeah. We've spoken many times. We have spent many times at the at this conference over the years.
That's right.
We are apparently we're moderating. I am moderating a panel that you've put together.
It's going to be great.
What is the title of the panel?
It's called Why Joe Biden is the Least Electable Major Democrat in 2020.
I thought it was going to be, is Joe Biden the least electable?
Oh, or is that an open, I'm pretty sure we have a point of view on that.
Right. Well, I mean.
It's actually, no, it's why Joe Biden is the least electable.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just moderating the panel.
Yeah.
and so.
Amy Allison from She the People will be joining us, and Alejandra Rojas from Justice Democrats.
We just played an interview with her from Justice Democrats.
Fantastic.
I have yet to meet Amy, I think, but it should be interesting conversation.
We'll be good.
And we'll test that premise. All right, but let's. I have no need for you to give a preview because I think I'm going to record it, and so we'll be able to play it in the coming days.
Live.
It will. It, maybe we could stream it live. That's conceivable. But we will record it in video and put it up.
Okay.
It'll look good.
Sounds great.
Adam.
Yes.
Give me your thoughts of where we are in terms of what's happening in Congress. Are you focused now on the presidential campaign?
We're focused on both. This week, our group is pretty vocal in defending Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from the attacks from Nancy Pelosi. You know, it's interesting how everybody talks about unity and no circling firing squad, and then progressives can get attacked by the establishment, progressives can be attacked by the conservatives, and that's fine. But if you fight back, stop the fighting.
Right.
Right. We even put out a sticker that said, I stand with AOC. And some people are like, why are you putting out that sticker? It merely says, I stand with AOC. And people are like, stop it. I was like, what are you talking about? Now, the next day, there's actually a street artist in D.C. who at 1 o'clock in the morning a couple nights ago started putting up signs with Pelosi's face and the words, visited the camps yet? And they started, you know, I put it on Twitter, started going viral, and we decided to actually make a campaign out of it. So actually now, if people are on the boldprogressives.org email list, we have a petition to Pelosi being like, visit the camps and bring Josh Gottheimer and Elaine Loria and Abigail Spanberger and the other conservative Democrats with you. Because if you guys are going to be undermining AOC and others who are trying to help the kids at the border, at least see it for yourselves.
It is pretty stunning that you hear a lot about things like purity tests are problematic, et cetera, et cetera. They may be, but I mean, this is just, you've got to toe the line and not fight, not get out in front of the sort of the capitulation that is going on here. I mean, it feels like Nancy Pelosi has decided in like the second quarter of a basketball game, we're going to four corners, you know, we're just going to run out the clock. And nobody's told her, like, well, you just can't do that. Like, what is supposed to fill the time between now and if the Democrats aren't going to do any oversight, they're not going to impeach. What's supposed to fill the time between
messaging bills?
How many more messaging bills do we have?
Exactly.
Right. I mean, there's.
I mean, look, this is the thing that we just run up against all the time, which is a conventional wisdom in D.C. is so out of touch with the actual conversation in the country, right? It's this idea of like, oh, if AOC wasn't talking about X, Y, or Z, we would just get so much more attention for this random bill that no one's ever heard of on the House floor, right? It's like, no, that is not true, right?
Are they telling themselves that?
Yeah,
is that what they think this is?
That is actually what they think a lot of this is. Yeah. And then... Wow, am I breaking news to you? Fascinating.
I had no idea that they actually think the reason why people aren't paying attention. Because 3 weeks ago, Mary Bustos Sherry Bustos was complaining that no one was paying attention to the bills. Well, 3 weeks ago, we weren't having this fight between AOC and Pelosi either.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's again, broken in every way. So the other part of the broken, there we go. Should we stop right here?
No, just the slide over. The other part of the broken...
The broken conventional wisdom is...
Slide down just a little bit, guys, so that we can get Ryan on camera. There you go. Ryan, just a little bit further down, a little bit towards... I know it's uncomfortable, but... Adam, move down a little bit. There we go. All right. Here we go.
What's up, y'all?
There we go. Ryan Grimm, of The Intercept and, of course, TYT. What do you put on your badge, Ryan? You just put The Intercept.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't actually tell them to put anything. So they just, that's what they went with.
All right,
yeah.
Fair enough. I got Ring of Fire on my badge, and so...
Ring of Fire, nice. I'm going to add TYT right now, actually.
All right.
And I'm going to add Strong Arm Press.
Oh, that's right. Everybody, we spoke to you about your book, and you have your whole press. All right, well, Adam and I were just talking about how apparently there's a feeling on the Hill amongst the Democrats that the reason why America is not paying attention to the messaging bills, and I think the messaging bills are great. I think it's important. I think we should be. But the reason why America is not paying attention to them is because AOC has been testy with Nancy Pelosi. Is that what the theory is?
Well, I think that Pelosi and her leadership crew will look for like any answer to explain why the public isn't paying attention to their messaging bills, other than the obvious one that the public has sense and like, A, knows that these messaging bills aren't going to become law through Mitch McConnell, and B, knows that they're, you know, mostly just fortifying the, you know, the status quo. There's some of them that actually would make significant change in the country, like the HR1, which is the anti-corruption bill.
Right.
But I think the public probably also has a lot of suspicion that, you know, if they knew that HR1 had passed and what was in it, whether they would actually pass it if they knew that a Democratic president would sign it. Because they've seen this before with the Republicans repealing Obamacare how many times?
Yeah. 52 times. Yes. And I think like the value of these bills really have more value to the progressive base as a marker and holding them to that in the future. Right? Like, so the general public, I mean, at what point do they give up that ghost? Or is this sort of like a sunk cost type of thing? Like, they can never admit that their strategy did not work.
Can't, right? How do you admit that? If you admit that, you have to go. So, I mean, it depends on what you mean by strategy.
Well, like, I mean, strategy as in like that hypothetical thing that should take place right. when you run a major political party. Like that right. type of thing. Like, because I will say this. The reason why nobody noticed HR1 was because Nancy Pelosi was shitting on Ilhan Omar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go back and you look at the week in the run-up, she decided to engage in that fight.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later, with a whimper, they introduce HR1 or they, you know, a champion. I mean,
right.
they shot themselves in the foot. And it suggests to me that they lack a strategy. They lack a plan to execute the strategy. And that, at the end of the day, the most...
They also lack an understanding of the current politics. And I was actually talking to a Democratic leadership aide about that moment just recently. And they thought it was a fairly straightforward play. Ilhan Omar talked about Benjamins and AIPAC. Congress is going to condemn her. Next, like that's the kind of thing they would have done in 10 minutes in 1994. And then moved on to the next thing. And he said that they were just floored at the reaction. They just did not see it coming. They were stunned to see so many people supporting her and condemning Democratic leadership. And so they had to then recalculate, say, oh, okay, this politics of Israel have changed, huh?
Right.
Interesting.
But they didn't notice that when, like...
you can't notice everything.
But did they not notice it when... Tim Kaine, of all people, wouldn't go see Bibi Netanyahu when he was speaking on the floor. Like, are they not, like, I don't understand. I can't help you
understand that.
It wasn't just that the politics of Israel have changed. It's that, given the current internet world, people like AOC and Ilhan have massive grassroots following that they
right.
had in 1994. Right?
Right.
The public has more of a voice through these people. And they can't just, you know...
Right, things that used to be just an inside yeah. play are now both.
Yeah, right. So what we were talking about before is that there's so much broken conventional wisdom, and I feel like it's broken conventional wisdom compounded upon more broken conventional wisdom. So let's use Medicare for All and this recent child detention thing as two examples, right? Medicare for All, the broken conventional wisdom in D.C. is, oh, that's not popular, or it's not popular in swing districts, right? when if you make the case correctly, it's overwhelmingly popular. You just need to take on the big insurance companies and make clear that you can keep your doctors. You know, nobody loves their insurance companies. But because of that, it's a nuisance when progressives bring up things like Medicare for All, right? So part of the messaging thing, messaging bills usually equal lowest common denominator. Like, what are the lowest principles that we can all agree on? Don't rock that boat because that's hurting the frontliners, these red to blue people who are scared, right? Same with the child detention stuff. Like, what could be more American or human than children should not be in cages, don't separate children from their parents? Honestly, like, that should, if we're going to engage in the immigration fight, that is the equivalent of the first trimester abortion in the abortion fight. Like, we want to be arguing on that turf, right? We don't want to be arguing about late-term abortion necessarily, right? There's other places that they can move the debate, but we should be willing to say, no, we're going to stand up for these children.
This is the
Everyone will
lowest
agree with us.
Of low-hanging fruit.
It should
I mean,
be.
The only other thing that could be more low-hanging fruit is that you should actively investigate and criticize the former prosecutor who gave a sweetheart deal to a child trafficker.
Right.
Right? Like,
right.
That's also pretty low-hanging right. fruit.
So all this stuff is seen as controversial in D.C. when it's not in the real country, and that means if progressives are doing the will of the people on the outside and trying to insert it on the inside, they are then hit back, right? So we were talking before about how it's fine for Pelosi to hit AOC, but if AOC pushes back, that's not unity. Right. And it's fine for Josh Gottheimer to attack AOC. That's fine. But if she hits him, oh, my gosh, you're hurting the frontliners. So it's really broken to many levels.
I feel like there should be some type of law that they should pass or a rule in the caucus that you need to hire, you know, some, there has to be some, well, at least one, like, token hire of somebody who has not been in Democratic politics for like 25 years, right? Like, every office has got to have at least one person they go to, like, hey, just to check this bounce check off.
They do. They have their kids.
I, with all due respect to Christine Pelosi, I still haven't forgiven her for humanizing George Bush in her documentary, frankly.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Well, that was 20 years ago, 15 years ago, but
might have been Alex Pelosi. Was that different? Was it?
Oh, yeah, that was Alex Pelosi.
Oh, it was Alex Pelosi?
Yeah.
Okay.
Christine does the environment stuff.
All right. Well, my apologies then. Yeah. But nevertheless, my apologies to both of them. I think it's going to be outside your family.
I think that's fair.
I think it's going to be fair. So where does
Christine Pelosi might literally be a lawyer from California.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, there you go.
Her picture.
Thank you.
Sorry. Anyway, sorry.
Thank
I
you.
I believe in comedy that's called a callback.
That is a callback, okay. Yes. I'm not sure about the comedy, it's a callback.
If it was funny, it would have been
laughing
a callback.
Liberally around here.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, so wow. What happens? Like, do we just keep going in this, like, sort of Nancy Pelosi thinks she can, there's some type of clock she can run out, and then everybody's going to be like, oh, yeah, forget it.
Yeah, she thinks there's a clock running out. She thinks that the August recess bleeds into September, and then you've got Labor Day, then you've got, you know, a couple weeks, and then you've got Thanksgiving, and then you've got a Christmas break, and then Iowa's voting. Like, that's her. That's how she's seeing the
and
calendar.
And then she thinks once the voting starts that nobody's going to pay attention
right,
to
once
Congress.
Right. I mean, now you're voting on who's going to be president. Why do you impeach the one who's currently sitting there?
There is a serious, I think, like, cultural problem with the Democratic Party. Because I think, like, that's been the problem with Democrats, is that they're too reliant on the presidency and are too focused exclusively on, like, let's elect a president, let's walk away.
Although I'm not even sure Pelosi's thinking about that. I think to her it's those frontliners. Like, yeah. to her, so we're facing a fascist in the White House, children dying on the border, now 11 years to make, you know, fundamental structural changes to save the planet from catastrophe. And her top concern really is these frontliners. And she would justify it by saying, well, if the frontliners don't win, then you're never going to, you know, hold power in order to address all the things you say you want to address. But in order for those frontliners to win, in her mind, you can't ever try to exercise that power. So it's a self-defeating thing. But so I don't even know if she's worried about. I mean, of course she'd like to see Trump beaten. But the House majority is her number one goal, period.
But does she think... But are those two things mutually exclusive? Like, is there a scenario where Donald Trump wins and the Democrats can maintain their majority?
Yeah, because it's the fascinating phenomenon of the suburbs, which are, you know, which is where Democrats picked up a lot of their gains in 2018. They were pissed off at Donald Trump, but they'll still be pissed off at Donald Trump in 2020. So it could return Democrats to the House majority, but that doesn't mean that he can't run up enough numbers in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania to also at the same time get reelected. Like, so I think there's a conceivable mood in the country that could do both. He would absolutely lose the popular vote again.
Right.
But there is certainly a path that he could do that and then hold on to those three key states.
But if the suburbs are going to vote against Donald Trump, then they're not paying attention to, wow, they're having too many oversight hearings. Like, I don't like how many oversight hearings that show me how corrupt the guy I hate is. I just don't understand the
I think there's a real risk of all of those people who did all of that organizing and door knocking and phone banking and donating that gave Democrats their huge wins in 2018 are now asking themselves, why did we do this?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I understand how it can work that way, where she loses because they're not doing anything. But I don't understand what the argument is that people are going to see that we're investigating a guy who let a pedophile off easy. Or people are seeing that we're investigating how he didn't pay his taxes. Or we're investigating how Betsy DeVos owns stocks in these.
No, it absolutely makes no sense because, like you said, they won the majority on anger at Donald Trump in these particular districts. So, of course, they want you to go after Trump. That's why they voted for you. So they're not going to get mad if you go after Trump.
Of course. Are you guys noticing much more energy around challenges to incumbents at this?
More than before. I don't know. You've been engaged in primaries before people cared about them. Are you seeing more this time?
Yeah, I think for a couple reasons. One, last time people were so paranoid about we must take back the House that some people were like, even if I technically agree with this progressive challenge, like I just want to focus on taking back the House, right? And now it's like, all right, other things are happening. I can divide my attention. But also AOC proved the concept, right? She proved that, oh, not only can we win these races, which would have been nice by itself, but, oh, and they're a game changer once they get in there. So the idea of let's elect more AOCs is a phraseology that we're applying to other candidates now. And I will say Justice Democrats has been, I think, very thorough about the types of candidates that they're vetting, people who are truly viable. You know, I think last time they had a wide game, like let's endorse 100 or more. I think this time they're going to be...
They might not have endorsed Ocasio-Cortez this new model.
Well, right. Well, I don't know about that. But basically, they have a prism for decision-making.
Probably.
Okay.
You know, the demographics work for the district, and she clearly was articulate and good on...
You're saying they would have.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I mean, statistically speaking, the odds of them doing it would have been less, right? I mean, it's hard.
Right.
It's hard to go back and look at that. But the idea is they're being more focused this time.
People who are truly committed to running strong races, people who fit their district, incumbents who are extra out of touch, places where in the past there's low turnout, which is in a weird way an advantage for us in a primary, if that maintains, right? We got messed up with Tom Carper in Delaware, who is the most corporate senator out there. He does not represent a very blue state, but because of very high turnout compared to other places, and a somewhat weak campaign running against him, we lost. So I think they're looking for a combination of things, and we're
That's
very happy
an interesting
they're doing that.
Phenomenon, yeah. Right? Because on some level, that has been the conservative path to victory has been a maybe not as many votes, but votes that you can count on.
Yeah.
In off-year elections.
Yeah.
And it's about the depth of their commitment, not necessarily the breadth. And it feels like we're in an era where these primaries can be won, not necessarily with the number of people, but the depth of commitment of those people, because they're going to show up no matter what. And that having that force And it's almost like the podcast model versus the radio model.
Wow, say more.
Are you being facetious?
Not really, say more.
Oh, well, I mean, this show, I mean, when I launched this show, for instance, I knew and was talking to Maron, I knew that Maron was going to make more money on advertising, but I might have an opportunity to make more on membership because this, talking about politics, has a deeper connection to people than, you know, with all due respect to Mark Maron, although he doesn't care. You know, him trying to hook up with some actress by, you know, talking about himself.
Right.
But, you know, people love that show. A lot more accessibility, but they wouldn't necessarily pay to be a member.
Yeah.
Depth, right? As opposed to breadth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a, okay.
Yeah.
Freemium.
Freemium.
That's another word that has to do with, internet.
So anyway, it's worth putting a couple specific races on the radar.
Right.
So one, I think he just announced. Did Alex Morris just announce against Richie Neal? I heard that.
That
is true. So Richie Neal is a powerful Ways and Means Committee chairman who dragged his feet for months in requesting Trump's tax returns and dragged his feet for months.
Michael Brooks is old congressman, I believe, out in Springfield.
That was worth the interruption.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so dragged his feet for months, holding Medicare for All hearings. And when he actually requested Trump's tax returns, some people in the media treated him like a hero. Like, wow, look at this bold action. It's like, wait, he was dragged kicking and screaming by progressives. We were out there saying, we're going to primary him, right? Well, still, he's an old school, you know.
He turned it down from New York State. We're going to give him Trump's state taxes. And he said no.
No, thank you. No, thank you. We're good. Right.
We're good here.
We're good here. So Alex Morris, young, I believe he's gay, mayor of Holyoke, in Massachusetts, is going to be running a very vibrant campaign against him, and that could be similar to AOC, a shell shocker for the establishment. If the Ways and Means Committee chairman, who's putting the kibosh on things like Medicare for All, I think also Green New Deal, goes down, it sends a signal of our prism for decision making was a little bit wrong, right? We need a big victory like that against someone who's a crusty old insider.
You know, it's interesting because I thought the what you would see in terms of AOC to Crowley would be like what we saw with David Brat to Cantor. Now Brat is gone in a year and he did nothing. AOC has been ascended. She is probably the most exciting political figure, particularly congressperson,
since Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, honestly, right? Yeah. And totally dismissed insofar as it having any type of like greater repercussions. Like Cantor was like, this is shot across the bow for every single Republican. You know, Lindsey Graham has got to start talking like Donald Trump, you know, as soon as...
And they all adjusted. Because they were told to by Fox News as well, which the left doesn't have.
That's right.
With all due respect to the institution that we're speaking with right now.
I understand. You know, I understand. I'm doing my best.
All due respect to The Intercept and CYT.
Right.
They don't listen.
They don't listen. And it's going to be interesting to see if someone like Neil goes down, if they're going to recognize, like, that district is largely rural, one small mid-sized city, Springfield, but there's a lot of it's a fairly rural area. Yeah. And if they're just going to say, "Oh, it's Massachusetts."
Yeah.
And it's Western Massachusetts, or if they're going to say like, "Okay, this puts just about everybody in play." It's going to be interesting to see if these threats will have the desired effect. It'll change any behaviors.
Yeah.
But
do you want to hit the Quaylor race and the Elliott Engel race, or no?
I mean, those are a couple. I wasn't persuaded. Maybe I'll come around to it that Quaylor was a great target. Quaylor is probably the most right wing Democrat. And so there's two sides to this. So he's not that much of a internal player. Like he's not a, he's not a Richie Neal. He doesn't run Ways and Means. He's not in leadership. For that reason, I thought that he's also extremely powerful and popular back home. And he comes from like a dynasty. Doesn't mean he can't be beaten. But so the question is it worth the resources to go after him, given those things? The other argument is that he's a powerful voice on immigration
and on a lot of fiscal issues in very destructive ways inside the caucus. And so by taking that voice out, you're taking away one of the more destructive voices that a lot of the centrists who could go either way hear him say, oh, well, this is a Hispanic member from Texas, and he's saying this, so
right,
I'm going to
cover for
I'll go with him. So
policies.
In that sense, taking him out with a strong progressive like a Jessica Cisneros, you know, could be significant. Elliot Engel, you know, I'm not convinced he's not going to retire. It'll be interesting, but he's, you know, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, would be a huge shot at the kind of hawkish wing of the party if he manages to get toppled.
Who else do you think we're going to see go?
Lipinski has a very good chance of losing, but I don't think him going down would be seen as anything other than like an unpopular guy who's out of step with his district going down in the kind of way that you could lose a primary in 2012, and it would just be seen as losing a primary.
Right. Well, let me say a couple things on that. So first, Dan Lipinski, you know, the Democratic co-chair of the Pro-Life Committee, voted against Obamacare. Consistently votes with Wall Street.
It's against everything Democrats are for.
And it's like a 15-point Hillary district. So there's no reason for him to be representing. You know, his dad gave him this seat, basically, right? So up against Marie Newman, progressive challenger, Medicare for all, everything. One significance I do see here is it's a very early primary. I think it's like the first week of March, right? Which means Alexandria, hers was like July.
End of June.
So early means it can have ripple effects the rest of the cycle, right? There could be a fundraising, you know, boost in the step of every other progressive challenger if he goes down. So I see that as like helpful in the calendar sense.
Well, there's a couple other primary challengers on the ballot.
Could that also have the opposite effect, though, of like putting a bunch of people on notice who have been sleeping, or are those people no
longer
sleeping?
They're wide awake. And they're so wide awake that, so there are two other people running for the Lipinski seat that haven't done a lot in terms of campaigning and fit the mold of this old machine tactic of putting people on the ballot just to draw votes away. Like, people who are upset with Lipinski are going to vote against him. And so if you put three people on the ballot, that dilutes the opposition. You see that a lot in these kind of machine elections. They may be genuine candidates, like, and think that they have some path to victory, but they haven't been showing it, and they know that Newman, you know, came within a couple points of winning previously, and has the edge.
All right, we're just
what's going on here? Something's happening here.
Oh, just watching Virgil. Oh,
what it is okay. Not exactly clear.
No, okay. We're just we have other guests in the green room, and they're waiting in the green room, and they'll be over here in a second.
Okay,
but well, let's give it to them.
Well, yeah, we'll do that. But all right, so I mean, this is going to be an exciting primary season. It sounds like.
And if anybody wants to understand where all this came from, they need to read the book.
Yeah, I mean, how is your book doing? Because I feel like your book has gotten a lot of attention, and it really does capture this moment. I mean, or at least explains how we got to this moment.
Yeah, it's well-timed. Now, this is a country that doesn't read, so I'm not going to retire on this book.
Is there a book on tape yet?
It's coming.
Who's going to read it?
A reader of my newsletter read it, actually, like a subscriber to my newsletter. He said he emailed me. He's like, hey, I do this for a living. You want me to do your book? I said, great.
Well, that's pretty
Let's
good.
Let's do it. Yeah. I mean, the book was copy edited edited in interesting ways by like readers of the newsletter. I allowed people to see an early draft of it, and they made very useful comments like, this is confusing. I'd love to hear more about this. So the spirit of the book was actually brought to bear on the production of it, too.
That's pretty cool. That's an interesting way of... is anybody publishing books like that?
No, just us.
What do you mean by us?
Strong Arm Press.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Are there any other books coming out in the near future?
Yes. What do we got? We have a very cool book coming on Lane Evans.
Lane Evans.
Who was a populist, first guy to ever endorse Barack Obama.
Okay.
A populist Illinois congressman who represented a Republican-leaning or centrist district for decades. but did it in a way where he just took the fight to the Republicans and took the fight to business. The seat is now held by Sherry Bustos, who claims that there's just no other way to do it, except Lane Evans, just a couple cycles ago, was doing it. I think he retired in 2004 because he got ALS.
Fascinating. Any children's books coming out?
There is a fascinating children's book coming in September, I believe, by Stephanie Taylor. It is one of the best children's books.
My co-founder. Yes.
But it's one of the best children's books I've read. The moment I saw it, I was like, "Oh, this we have
for
to do this."
How old?
It's like a good. I think it's anything from 2 to 8, 9.
Is that a title?
What is the title?
I'm not sure, actually.
It's something like.
Do anything or something like that.
You can do it. Yeah, you can do anything. Yeah. It's a cool book about the power of imagination and translating into like real world accomplishments. It's a cool.
And your book is called
We've Got People.
We've got people.
All right,
Majority.
Ryan Grimm.
Majority.
Adam Green.
Yes.
Thank you so much, guys. Appreciate it. All right, folks. Now coming to. I guess it's just gonna be Matt. Well, what are you guys doing here? Have a seat.
I'm here too, but I don't know. I could get up.
Go ahead.
I want you to do it. He needs to learn a lesson.
Yeah. No, he's not supposed to go to the bathroom.
No, he's not. And he needs to be punished. So let's do this.
Wow. So this is I am surprised to see you guys here. Matt Chrisman, Will Maniker.
No, I'm Brendan James, actually.
Oh, Brendan. Jesus Christ.
I get that a lot. People say Will and I
thought you were looking a little bit like disheveled. I was going
to
say.
I don't know how to go from here. Okay. I've already been ambushed in this interview mistaken with Will.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
What are you guys doing here? Am I wrong to be a little bit surprised that you're here?
No, I think that's appropriate. I did it honestly just because we went to CPAC earlier this year.
Oh, I see.
And it was a lot of fun.
Tit for tat.
Exactly. And I thought like it would make sense to just see, because like if I remember correctly, this came out of an explicit desire to create like a liberal version of CPAC, right? Was that the idea? That wasn't the idea?
I don't think so.
I remember from those days of like the early Daily Coast where they were like, the conservatives have so many institutions. They've got all these think tanks. They've got these conferences. We don't have any of those. We need to get them. So I always thought it was like an answer to CPAC. Maybe that's not correct. I don't know.
It's supposed to be some sort of organizing.
Wait. Oh, sorry. I didn't even. What are you talking into the mic?
I am.
Do that again. There you go. Okay.
Hello, everyone out there in Radio Land.
Okay, good.
I don't know if it comes out of a direct competition or inspiration from CPAC itself, but I mean, it's clearly supposed to be a organizing
like a bookend
festival for
and
activists. And
we
stuff
got
like that.
Press credentials very easily to go to CPAC, so I just thought let's try it there, and they got them very easily. So like, well, let's just do it.
Did you get closer? Did you get credentials here?
Oh yeah, baby.
Now, are you guys like, are you doing a show?
No. No, it's honestly, for me, it's because I kind of want to write a piece about the two events and the two experiences of CPAC and Netroots Nation. So that's my agenda.
CPAC, I think, didn't start until 2011. I'm looking at this. I don't think it started until 2011.
What? Wow.
No. Matt Chrisman owned and fact-checked and debunked on
true.
Air.
CPAC is like a venerable institution on the right. Are we sure we're thinking of the same thing?
No, Matt, I'm not trying to gang up on you, but I don't really think it did come out of like a anti-CPAC.
The conference was founded in 74, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It goes back.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. Being gaslit.
Yeah.
Sam Cedar's gaslighting people, folks, and it's not okay.
We're making a lot of factual errors left and right today. So
it's Virgil's fault.
It is. It's all Virgil's fault.
Yeah, I got completely thrown off. Virgil was supposed to be here, but apparently he had to go to the bathroom.
He had to
go
to the bathroom.
He's in the toilet right now. That's not a joke.
No.
It's not a joke. He's in the bathroom.
So give me a little taste. How long you been here? You been here for 2 days?
We just got here yesterday.
No, we've been here for 2 days.
Yeah, but we didn't really do anything on Wednesday.
Oh, yeah.
What does it feel like you're doing much today?
No. No, we're not.
No, we don't do a lot when we come to these things. We just kind of walk around.
Okay. So what's the early verdict?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. It has very much the same model as CPAC. You've got the breakout sessions, and you've got the things. You've got the big panels. You've got the radio row. You've got the swag area. All I can say is that this one is, it's more diverse out, honestly, obviously. Everyone is more casually dressed. Everyone at CPAC is wearing a suit.
Right.
And the, at least what I've seen, it seems more, I mean, they're human beings. They're not they're right. not reptiles
You're not
like
walking.
They are at CPAC. I have to say, though, that the town hall area is much less lit than CPAC was.
I mean, it sounds like from, I wasn't with you at CPAC, but that the CPAC was high octane.
Oh, yeah.
And that makes sense, of course. You know, they're guys in power. They're very energized by that. However, one would then expect the opposition to be as energized from a different place. And I don't know. I wasn't at CPAC, but it feels a little thinner and a little less.
Funereal.
Yeah. It's a little, feels a little moribund, to be honest. I mean, like not to say that the left or whatever, center left or progressive side is itself moribund, but that this isn't maybe the place where all that stuff happens anymore. I don't know. I mean, we're mouthing off.
You are. I'm
of,
not saying anything.
Oh, well, I'm mouthing off. But, I mean, it does feel that way, and it's probably a good thing to at least acknowledge.
What, that it's more low-key, or that there seems to be...
Well, there's different strains that are fresh on the left right now than there were, say, back when this was founded. I mean, now you have right. an actual sense of the beginning of a working class, engagement from certain candidates. I mean, most of all, Sanders, probably, in my opinion, really only Sanders in the purest sense, that is probably more of a vehicle for the kinds of ideas and agendas that people used to think only could only happen by organizing things like this. You know, now you have a candidacy that is sort of doing that on its own, and a lot of people here, I think, are good with Sanders, but I don't know. I get the sense a lot of them are also kind of more professional, middle class, Warren type people, and that's it's a different energy. It's a different, you know, section of the base or whatever. And I think that's reflected walking around. So
yeah, I mean, I think this in 2015, actually, it was, there was a big movement here to draft Warren.
Yeah.
Before I think Sanders had gone to race. Maybe it was even 2014.
Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah.
And it obviously it didn't happen. I mean, I think that's probably accurate in terms of, like, you know, there's a lot of people here who work in institutions, and there's a lot of institutional on the left. And I just saw a poll today that said a story. I guess it was in Politico about the Morning Consult poll showed, or maybe it wasn't from that, but it showed their strengths are two different strengths.
Right, yeah. We were just looking at that. Yeah, it's like...
Oh, really?
Sorry, buddy.
Virgil, you just show up when you want. What? You just show up when you want.
I'm happy to cede my seat now that you're here, but... You know, I haven't been on the show in a while, and I'm here. He thought I was Will. That was a whole
I
bit we
was
did.
Will, yeah.
No, it makes sense.
It's not the first
Sam.
Thing that we've mistaken.
No, that's true.
Today.
But
Sam.
No, seriously, do you want to get in on this?
Sam, tell.
I don't know
Virgil,
if he's being past progressive. Why don't you sit down?
Tell Virgil.
Because he's about to start talking about polling, and that's really more your thing.
Go ahead.
Tell Virgil to wait for Will to be done.
We were just talking about the exact poll we were talking about right before you went to the bathroom, the one that showed that Warren and Sanders have different slices of the demographic pie for the primary electorate.
Sanders better with African Americans, better with rural folk. Warren better with folks with graduate degrees. It's a different. What are the implications of that? Because the left is split between two different bases.
I mean, it depends what you mean by the left. Because, you know, there's a lot of people on the anti-capitalist side of things who say, you know, we need to be going after, you know, more blue-collar workers, people who are more distinctly working class, distinctly doing worse than someone in a comparable position 40 years ago. And that's people who have lower educational attainment. They don't more rarely live in urban areas if they're white. Obviously, African-Americans are a substantial chunk of that, recent immigrants, Latinos, and so on. And to say we don't want, we should not be going after the PMCs, the professional managerial class types, who might still be, you know, under some Marxist analysis, you might arguably still call them working class. But if you're, say, a graphic designer who makes $85,000 a year, you're, and a single person, you don't raise a family, you know, your needs are very, very different from someone, say, who comes from a coal family in West Virginia, where there's really just isn't that sort of industry and that those sorts of opportunities.
But can you go after one of those groups and not the other and win?
I think you go after, I mean, if you're talking about going after, I honestly think you only really have to go after one, and that's the more working class voter who is less engaged, because they're the ones who you risk losing during a general, not necessarily to Trump, but to indifference. And that's the real issue. That's what defeated Hillary. It was not people flipping to Trump. It was people just not bothering. And those are the people that are least engaged in politics, most likely to sit an election out if they don't think that there's someone to vote for. Whereas these PMC people we're talking about, they vote every time. They're going to vote, and they're mostly liberals. They're convinced liberals. So even if they don't like Sanders as a first choice, they're going to vote for him. Whereas the people who liberals, you might alienate by going with a PMC strategy might stay home.
The other
and
problem
then you
is,
lose. You lose Pennsylvania or you lose Michigan like you did last time.
The other argument is that some of these PMCs that we're talking about, they might have class interests that are hostile to that first group.
Right.
And so arguably, you know, it would become a theoretical impossibility to create a functional permanent coalition there. Maybe right now, because of the exigency of Donald Trump, you could get these two groups to unite. But in terms of actually creating a governing coalition, that's another story.
Who was it that stayed home, though, like relative to, let's say, the Obama coalition? Because my understanding is that a lot of the people that stayed home were African Americans, and maybe a lot of them were also disenfranchised. You know, you're talking about Wisconsin, talking about Michigan, Pennsylvania. I imagine it was more of a cross section. But where did they? I mean, who's and Bernie does better with African Americans than Warren does, but Biden does better than Bernie, right? I mean, so is there a sort of a set of material benefits that you can offer that will motivate people in that way?
Well, but I want to address that point that Biden does better than Bernie with African American voters, because first of all, they have essentially the same favorability ratings among African Americans in this country, which is astronomically high.
I'm sorry, say again.
Bernie and Biden have comparable favorability ratings among African American voters, which is extremely high. They are
right.
The two, far and away, the two most popular candidates in this field among Black Democrats. So I don't really I don't really think it's a case that one will do better than the other.
But do you think that they're offering, it seems to me, very different prescriptions.
They are, but I mean, here's the real thing. Everyone talking about how, you know, all of these voters are on some ideological spectrum, right? And that, you know, if Kamala Harris is a cop, it's going to be a deal breaker, and all, you know, all of this little stuff, or that Warren is taking voters from Sanders. The vast, vast majority of the people who are going to be voting in these primaries do not really have coherent political agendas. They have a general idea of what should be done. They have strong views on certain issues, you know, pretty clear litmus tests. But beyond that, you know, for a lot of them, you see, you know, oh, Joe Biden, yeah, right. He was Obama's vice president. He's a liberal. He's a lefty guy. Oh, Bernie Sanders, he's a liberal. You know,
right.
They're not focused on this granular distinction between democratic socialism and liberalism and things like that.
Yeah, that's my sense too. I mean, so then the question becomes like, how much of this is just, you know, turn off the sound and people are, you get a notion of who they're going to vote for.
I think that ultimately policies have never decided a Democratic primary. And it's really come down to two. I think there's two types of Democratic nominees you get. One is someone who seems like a president who's going to win. And there's no particular affection for this person. Like John Kerry is a good example
right.
of that. And the other is someone who represents...
I really liked John Kerry.
You like him? Oh, okay. Well, you were, yeah, you, Sam was the only guy who was like, you know, I'm identity politics for John Kerry.
I did have lunch with him. My mom won lunch with him with the JCC auction like 30 years ago, and I had lunch with him. He was nice.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
And the other is someone who doesn't represent necessarily a platform, but represents a general concept, a general, right. a strong idea or ideological bent. And Obama's a great example of that.
Right, which was just sort of some vague notion, I'm a change agent.
I'm changed. This is the reaction to Bush. I'm not Bush. We're going to turn back, roll back the clock on all of the Bush stuff.
And also represents like a breakthrough, you know, like a demographic that has been unrepresented in presidential
right.
politics
well, that was
finally
change,
being able to.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
that was the sort of subtext of the word change at that point was yeah, like, yeah. we're going to, this is a big change.
Yeah.
Right. By virtue of being a black presidential candidate, you know, he himself, by his skin color, represented his message and vice versa.
So, Matt, has this conversation changed your perspective on what's going on here?
No, I've been hearing this from Virgil all year long. No,
does it change your perspective on the conference?
I don't really have one. Like I said, I've only been here really a day. I haven't really. I dropped in on one of the panels for a few minutes. I'm really looking forward to the tomorrow. When they have the round table or whatever it is, the presidential candidate show. It's kind of interesting, though. It seems like a thin herd.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very surprised that – I'm not surprised that, you know, like Joe Biden didn't come. That doesn't surprise me. I'm not shocked that Bernie Sanders didn't come. But I'm super surprised that, like – Cory Booker's not here.
Right.
And Kamala Harris, who have been here in the...
Yeah, Kamala Harris, honestly, is the one that baffles me the most, because she's, like, she's gaining steam. She's becoming people's, like, people's giving her a second look. And, like, it's time for her to, like, get some sort of identity outside of one a snap moment on Biden in the debate. And coming to a place like this seems like it would be ideal.
It
and so,
like
yeah.
There's a lot of people here who are the sort of people that you want to charm right now
yeah.
and have them say, oh, I'm with you.
Right, or you want people here to be like, she's now my second.
Right,
date.
Exactly. At least be on someone's like scorecard.
Yeah, especially, I mean, if you have someone who's going to go back and is a well-known local organizer, you know, you want them on your side, even if they're not in one of the first four primaries. Which yeah. I kind of think a lot of people just aren't really looking forward to Super Tuesday at this point. But there's no reason Kamala Harris should not be doing that.
Yeah, it's a little bit surprising in that regard. It's going to be interesting to see. If we're going to see the same activism that we've seen in the years past.
Sam, if I could go back one second to a question you posed to Matt, if anything that he's been hearing from our conversation has changed his mind, and I believe the answer was no on that one. He says he's been hearing this sort of thing from me for months. I want to say that I've been saying a lot of things for months that are currently being manifested in reality that are absolutely true. And one was the emergence of the Orb Gang.
Yes.
100% true.
Well, that was all you, and I give you credit for that one.
The other was, and I said it on our show. I said it to you months. I said it to you before 2019 began. And I believe, and you can go back to the tape on this. I believe I said it on your show too, and that's Joe Biden will not be the nominee.
I think it's too early for you to say that you've been affirmed in that.
I've not been confirmed in that. But the process that I described of why he won't be the nominee. Has been happening, and Kamala Harris hastened that on the debate, and that's the exact thing that I'm talking about.
It is. I think you can go back 3 months on our show and hear me say that by end of September, beginning of October, he is third in the polls. And I would only amend that now by saying I think he's going to be fourth in the polls by then. These people don't like Joe Biden.
They don't like Joe Biden.
People think they know Joe Biden, but they don't know Joe Biden.
They just remember him standing behind Obama for 8 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
I mean, yeah, I will agree that the process that he put out of just as soon as the first
real attention gets paid, the numbers just starts going down.
Yeah.
The trend line, that is what people, I mean, that was my original thought, too, is, yeah,
oh,
it's
really?
Going to fade.
Oh, it was your original.
It was. Okay. I play the tape back. I said it.
Okay.
It's just that then he had that huge lead, and, of course, because, you know, if you're on the left, you give it towards panic and horror
right.
at all times.
Right.
You just assume, oh, it's over. You second guess yourself and third guess yourself.
Do you guys have a lot of, like, instances where you think that you said something and the other guy did, or vice versa? Like, I mean, does that happen a lot?
We have had moments like that, but thankfully we can go to the tape and we can make sure.
You guys don't strike me as guys who go to the tape.
No.
I mean, if we had
you always say you're going to go to the tape, but I don't.
Well,
feel
we're
like
saying we're hoping someone else goes to
exactly.
the tape.
Exactly. Ideally, and the thing is, our fans are, I guess I'd say, focused enough to do that for us.
Yes.
We have enough people who are very. Very assiduously attend to the program who can remind us who said what. We don't have to actually do it.
We have a couple of fans who do that as well.
Yes.
Keep a very specific record of almost everything I've ever said.
I do want to put another chip down right now. And I forget if I did say this on our last election roundup for our show, but I'll say it. I'll iterate it on your program that I will bet on the trifecta. And say that this race will come down to Bernie, Warren, and one other candidate, who I believe will be Kamala Harris.
I think
this is substantially likely, especially after her debate performance.
And the thing is I guess I kind of agree with that, and I see the contours even shaking shape now. I think the difference, and I will stress that I am trying to be largely agnostic about all this stuff.
He doesn't want to make a bet against me again.
I've lost enough bets. That I know that I cannot see into the hearts of my fellow citizens nearly well enough to be confident
Matt,
on this
Matt,
stuff.
Matt, I'm not a very good gambler. I mean, shoot, why don't we just, I don't really want to bet you, but if you want, you're practically taking money out of my wallet here.
Yeah, all right. keep going.
All right.
I think that if that does come to pass, if that shapes up to be the race, certainly early, by Super Tuesday, then I don't see Harris losing, honestly, is the thing. That's where we differ.
Well,
I think, I mean, for whatever Harris's strength, and she has many strengths, and under this theory that this theory says that the sort of establishment forces of the party, anybody but Warren Sanders crew.
Really anybody but Bernie, though.
Right.
Would
coalesce around Harris. But I also think that Warren is broadly acceptable to most of the party. And I kind of think it would more look like anybody but Sanders will divide between Harris and Warren. In that position, I mean, I think Warren is best positioned. But you just can't count out Sanders' organizational capacity and
right.
a national organizational capacity.
That's the thing I think we have yet to see, really.
Because yeah, he didn't
and
really
we
have that
see,
last time.
Yeah, he didn't have that last time, and I think we won't really know until we start to get into the primaries, like, if that is actually what we think it might be.
Right.
But Will Menaker, Virgil, Texas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks
for having us. So I'm usually the one thanking.
Yes.
I got
thank
confused
you.
There.
Thank you so much. All right, folks. Let's go through a couple of sounds as we wrap this up. I'm going to be doing the panel here. You guys might be interested in this. There's going to be a panel an impromptu panel that we're putting together and asking the question, why is Joe Biden the least electable in the camp.
That sounds good.
In the camp. This is going to be at 4 p.m. right here. Yes.
Wait, you said 4 p.m.?
4 p.m. All right. Okay, folks. So we will have part one of our coverage up later in the day, and we'll go through some of our.
Did you see this Bernie GIF, Sam?
I did not.
Check
what is
it out.
The,
if you're looking at the sound sheet, I included a link to it. I'm going to put it up on screen here. I mean, I think it's all the argument he needs to be as far as who's the candidate should be for 2020.
Yeah, this is the ultimate endorsement right here.
I will take a look at this.
This is him basically, for people who are listening, he's on Wall Street. And he's basically recording.
I see.
You see? Yeah. I mean, he's recording one of his videos, presumably something to do with bank regulation or maybe the transaction tax to fund the student debt relief, student debt cancellation. And a UPS guy just walks by him and gives him a pat on the shoulder and gives a little pump of the fist. And I mean, I believe her when she says it. Bree said to me, like, this is quite very much the normal response that Bernie gets from, basically people with jobs across the country, people in, waiters, and so on.
I've talked to a bunch of people who have gone to the Deep South with him, going to, not an Outback Steakhouse, but some restaurant like that. And literally, like, half the kitchen staff comes out to just say hi.
They want to meet the guy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't flinch a bit either. It's awesome.
Yeah. No, he just kind of, it's very natural.
People are hitting me all the time.
So I'm always getting a pat on the shoulder from the UPS guys.
So, all right, let's talk about Labor Secretary Alex Acosta. Who knew that you could not be the guy who gave a sweetheart deal to a pedophile and not make it in the Trump administration? Now, of course, all the reports are that conservatives have been unhappy with him because he hasn't been aggressive enough in attacking labor, and so they're willing to jettison him. Here is Donald Trump talking about Alex Acosta.
You know what I know? You know what I know about Alex? He was a great student at Harvard. He's Hispanic, which I so admire, because maybe it was a little tougher for him and maybe not. But he did an unbelievable job as the Secretary of Labor. That's what I know about him. I know one thing. He did a great job. And until this came up, there was never an ounce of problem with this very good man. Go ahead.
Let me just add, I hear a lot about how individuals got jobs and whatnot. Before our interview, we had never met, we had never talked. The president selected me as it should be done. It wasn't that we knew each other. It's not that we had a long-standing relationship. And I think that's a testament to his selection process.
I have the best selection process.
What a powerful communicator.
Quite a lot of protesting.
He was perfectly great except for letting the billionaire child sex trafficker off. Aside from that, totally clean.
But maybe in another sense, that was also good. That also helped.
I love that he was Hispanic, which might have made things tougher for him, or maybe that's all lies, but either way, good job.
Either way, good job being Hispanic. Aces. Did you see, there was a really weird quote in a Daily Beast article that came out, though, yesterday, where supposedly, and it kind of surprised me, that he was actually asked about this. In his, now I'm really starting to get the chair thing because I'm literally finding these guys distracting from here on screen. But at any rate, he was asked, supposedly during the Trump transition, they asked him, we have the quote. Why did he cut this? He was actually asked why he cut Epstein a sweetheart deal. And Acosta told the Trump people that, quote, I was told to back off, that Epstein was above his pay grade, and I was told that, quote, Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone. And, I don't usually go in that direction, but I would like to know what that meant.
Or who told him that.
I mean, maybe he made it up out of whole cloth, but on the other hand, it seems to me that clearly this is a guy who, the whole Epstein thing even implicates people and institutions that there's zero evidence that they were involved in the worst of it. But it's worth asking, why were so many prominent scientists flying on this plane? Why were, institutions like Harvard still taking money from him even after he was convicted?
Without a doubt, what would be a great So if we had some type of mechanism where we had, like, I don't know, like representatives of us that had resources and mechanism and abilities to investigate things and make, you know, so the public would know about them that dealt with our government, that would be great.
That would be, you know what, you know what's funny is you were talking about Richie Neal earlier, and I don't know that much about him, but he was not my congressman growing up because there was a guy named John Oliver who was the congressman, and then they cut a new district, so now he actually does cover where my mother lives. And but you knew about him, and I think, like, in some ways, Richie Neal, he's always been such a pure machine politician. He's as disinterested in what Donald Trump is doing as in, like, the mafia's role in Springfield as a city. Like, he's just been doing a job where he, like, delivers for a narrow set of interests and looks the other way on everything for decades. And I guess Trump is no different.
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty nuts. And we clearly need more investigation into this. And I don't know if we're going to get it. I mean, I don't know what the mandate is of the Southern District of New York, how wide ranging this will be. And I have no sense of what the timetable is. But this is what you would anticipate from Congress if we didn't have, you know, a Speaker of the House who seemed to be mad that people are demanding Congress do some oversight.
It's very nice you want investigations. Don't ever tweet about it.
Let's check in on Tucker Carlson, who apparently, I don't know if he felt like he had too many advertisers or what, but has decided to go back to his roots, as it were.
Play the hits.
Maybe he got some, consumer reports that say that Ilhan Omar, if he continues on and otherizes her more, that the ratings will pop up. But here he is with Brooke Goldstein, executive director of the Lawfare Project. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is pretty stunning. I mean, do people not have any idea of, like, what her background is or, like, where she came from? It's. But go ahead. Let's play this.
Brooke Goldstein is a lawyer who has followed the Ilhan Omar saga from the very beginning, and she joins us tonight. Brooke, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Her remarks about Israel reveal something, perhaps, about what she believes about the world. What do you think those remarks tell us?
Well, first of all, this is a woman who, by the way, called you a white supremacist, and the irony there is that if she wasn't a member of Congress, she'd be a member of the KKK. Yes, she's commented on Israel, but she has built a career on attacking American Jews.
Wow.
That's a misunderstanding wow. of not just Ilhan Omar, but also the KKK, it seems to be.
Yeah.
The KKK was known for an active outreach to Somali refugee communities because for specifically the Somali refugee community of people who supported a two-state solution based on 67 borders. That was a sweet spot for
Whoa.
Them.
Have I really misunderstood the KKK?
Yeah, I mean, there was a reason Jeff Sessions was so skeptical of them. They were a working-class organization that wanted to work with Somali migrants to preserve Palestinian human rights,
and
but also still
weed.
Ensure a Jewish state. And they expanded their consciousness through active marijuana usage. Yeah, I had no idea.
There's
I mean, that is the big lie stuff. I mean, I have to say that's like when I go on I-24 sometimes, some of those opening packages are just so, I mean, not that bad, but that the in the right wing of Israeli propaganda there, that is actually not that out of the norm to hear stuff like that.
I I would, you know, we're going to see a poll that's going to come out at one point where, you know, 75% of Republicans have name recognition for Ilhan Omar, and Democrats have, like, you know, 45% name recognition. They did the same thing with AOC. They're just going, literally, just like walking through and creating new boogie women to replace Nancy Pelosi.
Boogie persons.
Absolutely. Although I think it's really...
I want to say boogie persons, but really, like, they've never successfully, I think... Maybe they did it with Bill Clinton, but they've never successfully really made a boogie man out of anybody in Congress. They tried it with Harry Reid. You know, Rush Limbaugh, the best he could come up with is calling him Dingy Harry. That was his Dingy Harry. Yeah, it just didn't work.
Weird. No, you know, that doesn't work.
Mark Levin calls Chuck Schumer Schmucky Chucky or whatever.
I like that one, actually. I can appreciate it. It sounds right to me.
But I don't think it sticks with people on the right. But when they go after women, particularly younger women, particularly young women of color, it's a ratings boon for them. It's a ratings boon.
And we really always have to say, especially in Ilhan's case, and obviously now everything's blowing up with, you know, Pelosi going at AOC, but I mean, you had, speaking of Schmucky Chucky,
yep,
you had him and, to a slightly lesser degree, but with the same substance, and Steny Hoyer, all three of them were at AIPAC endorsing essentially the most obscene attacks on Ilhan Omar. So I agree with you that it's, you know, it's certainly of a kind, but she is of the most extreme degree.
Yeah, I mean, we have this clip where she apparently, in a closed-door meeting, said, don't tweet your complaints. But if you can take them to AIPAC, apparently it's fine.
Yeah, don't tweet anything, but I will gladly endorse the most grotesque, you know, incitement against you at a, you know, right-wing ethno-state political gathering. That you can do.
Well, let's hear about that clip. This is Joe Scarborough and Casey Hunt talking about Nancy Pelosi telling progressive members not to tweet their complaints.
She has said some demeaning things to these four members, and the four members have said some demeaning things to Pelosi. The question is, when do they sit down in a room and say, this is a big place, we can all help each other, let's start working together?
So, Joe, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made a really interesting comment to The New Yorker in an interview last week. She said, a lot of this is premised on the idea that I have a relationship with Nancy Pelosi at all. She said she hadn't talked to her at any length basically since the wintertime. And I think that tells you a lot about how this relationship has played out. And I think that there are some risks here for Pelosi. So far, it has been this uneasy detente where, you know, the squad, quote unquote, has watched Nancy Pelosi win a couple messaging victories. They've seen her take on Donald Trump. They've seen her, you know, stride out of the White House, put on those sunglasses and have her be a hero for the same, you know, liberal base that sent them to Washington. But these comments are getting very dismissive. And, you know, Pelosi simply looks at the world in a completely different way. And I think my question about this going forward is the same one that you had just then about Newt Gingrich, which is, you know, we're living in a different type of media environment and world. And, you know, Pelosi told Maureen Dowd, oh, you know, they've got their public whatever. The question is, can you really dismiss that public whatever in the age of Trump in a way that you used to be able to? I mean, Nancy Pelosi is a hard power person inside the House. She's counting votes. She's not wrong. These are only four votes. That is not enough to change the calculus. And she knows what it takes to actually get things done in the House. But the reality is, you know, politics has changed around us just in, you know, the few short years that this president has been in office. And the confidence that these people, frankly, don't have in the basic functioning of the House of Representatives means that, you know, she's taking some real risks in pushing them away so aggressively.
Well, and she...
Yeah, I mean, people coming up and talking to me.
Wait, now Adam Green's interrupting the segment?
Yes, now Adam Green's interrupting me.
Adam, stop sabotaging us, Adam.
The point is that It's not even a question of it being the age of Trump. And this notion of, like, the tweeting and the, you know, it's shocking. And it's, first of all, you mentioned when, Nancy Pelosi went after Ilhan Omar. We were talking about this earlier. That's when they stepped on HR1's, rollout. In
right.
some way,
right.
to crap on Ilhan Omar, so
right.
it's completely a mess. Wait, but now I've got another.
I mean,
hold
do
on.
Do you what? Think?
Jesus, we have another interloper.
Yeah, we got another. Get yes.
Why doesn't Dane go to the chair?
Hold
now?
On, we got some breaking news. Hold on 1 second.
He should go to the other chair if that's open.
Go to the other chair to give us the breaking
okay.
news.
Okay, yeah, I will go.
Break it over there.
It's not. Yeah,
we got breaking news.
I actually do have breaking news.
All right, we have breaking news. This is David Dayan stepping in with breaking news.
We just reported at the Prospect that the United States is, as early as Monday, will be signing an agreement with Guatemala that will force asylum seekers from the Northern Triangle countries to process their asylum claims in Guatemala.
Oh, Jesus.
This is called a safe third country agreement, and it is done on the grounds that Guatemala is a safe country for asylum claims processing, even though it is racked with violence and has many of the same qualities as Honduras and El Salvador, and is one of the main countries where asylum seekers are fleeing from. But now we are going to push asylum seekers from Honduras and El Salvador into Guatemala for the purposes of asylum claims processing. It's basically outsourcing the camps that are in El Paso and whatever into essentially black sites in Guatemala.
And I would imagine also there's a massive opportunity for not just corruption, but real violence. Like, you've got to pay before you get into
right.
the door to apply for asylum. You've got to pay because there's
right.
no oversight, essentially.
I will read you the quote I got from Senator Merkley on this subject. The whole idea is that we can take people from Honduras and El Salvador and fly them to Guatemala, where they're absolutely in worse shape. They don't have friends. They don't have family. They don't have funds. So they're going from desperation to desperation. And that is the plan, to effectively outsource our asylum responsibilities to put these people who are already in trouble in even more of a hazardous situation.
Just
but
really
let me ask this, though. Does that in any way, I mean, just because people could get asylum theoretically from Guatemala, does that mean that they can't apply to the United States? In other words, like, why wouldn't people just say, okay, but I'm still going to the States?
It is a geographical impossibility if you are from Honduras or El Salvador and you're poor and you're not going to be able to fly.
Right.
If you're going over land, you have to go through Guatemala first.
Okay, so they will
under
stop.
This agreement, the first country you set foot in is the country you have to apply for asylum in. That is the notion of a safe third country agreement. So the U.S. can effectively say, well, you came in through Guatemala, and we have an agreement with Guatemala that they process claims of whoever sets foot in their country first, and so you're going to have to do it.
But does that implicate U.S. legislation? I mean, don't you have to change U.S. legislation to...
It's a bilateral agreement between two countries. It does not, mind, require any kind of legislative imprimatur.
I understand from Guatemala, but why would the law that says that if I get 1 foot in the United States, I have the right to apply for asylum, just because now if Guatemala doesn't let me go through Guatemala.
I will tell you this. The ACLU and other organizations are looking to challenge this agreement on the grounds that it violates international law, violates the 1954 Refugee Convention, It is clear that, first of all, Guatemala is not a safe country,
right,
for asylum. And second, that, you know, that may implicate some of the things you're talking about. We have an agreement of a safe third country with Canada right now. That's obviously a little more along the lines of reality, because Canada is indeed a safe country for asylum seekers. And in fact, that helps us. Usually what that means is more people are having to get asylum in the U.S. than Canada, since they're coming up from the south. But the way this would operate is it would take all of those migrants from the Northern Triangle seeking asylum at the border and ship them down to Guatemala. It's really a harrowing situation. Experts have said that this is a serious problem. And I can read you some more.
We're
going to
end up hearing about.
Thing.
I suspect we're also going to end up hearing about a lot of people dying going by boat.
Right, but that's true. That's probably true. You can see boat migration, and what you're also going to see is essentially an invisibility cloak placed over this entire cruelty in the camps,
right.
Because instead of having it done in El Paso that's subject to U.S. law, it'll be done, you know, somewhere in Guatemala that isn't. Here's some quotes. Eric Schwartz, the president of Refugees International, said that this is a violation of U.S. law. Says the law requires that the U.S. sign this agreement only with countries who have a full and functioning asylum system, which Guatemala actually does not. And it also says that the U.S. can't return people to a place where their lives are at risk, where they patently are within Guatemala. He says it's the distortion of the concept of a safe third country. This agreement uses an arrangement designed to provide protection for people in the most cynical and grotesque way. And so that's what experts are saying about this. You can expect a legal battle to come out of this. But it's happening. The president of Guatemala is flying to the U.S. on Monday. And there will likely be a signing ceremony. This is a guy, Jimmy Morales, who ran on an anti-corruption platform. But as soon as the UN agency looking into corruption in Guatemala implicated his family, he suddenly turned into an anti-corruption president. And yeah, there's probably something going on. Guatemala, interestingly, was one of the few countries that agreed with Trump in moving the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. Mm. They were trying to get on the U.S.'s good side, maybe to help the U.N. back off, get the U.N. to back off on this anti-corruption stuff. And now here's the quid pro quo. Trump's calling in the chit. He's trying to get them to take all these asylum seekers.
Michael, you got something on that?
Yeah, just really quick. I mean, yeah, that specifically in 2017, Morales expelled this Colombian, Ivan Vasquez, who was the head of the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, which was what David mentioned. That's sort of like how relentless the corruption was there, that there was a specific autonomous UN unit. He threw him out after they began investigating connections between his party and cartels. He also has had brother arrested. He's been accused of all sorts of personal misconduct. And, you know, the Israeli stuff, I would say, going back to the 80s, actually, you know, the Israelis were involved in training death squads in some of these junta countries as well. So he's a very right-wing leader with terrible human rights and also an evangelical, for what it's worth. So, I mean, totally aligned with Trump.
All right. Well, David, Dan, folks can head over to prospect.org to read the whole piece and find
That's
out.
That's correct.
Breaking news over there.
Breaking news over there. We're doing it. We're getting it done.
All right. Well, David, thank you for coming and letting us know. All right, folks, look, we are out of time. I got to wrap this up because I got some other interviews to do here. And, of course, it's just getting overrun by people. We got the big panel coming up, where we're going to ask the question, is Joe Biden the least electable Democrat? Or
I think you should frame it, is he too risky as a candidate for the general election?
Risky Joe.
Risky Joe, that's what I call him. Risky Joe.
Risky Joe.
Risky Joe. Maybe we get time for one more sound here. Where are we? Forgive me.
We should maybe do this far-right brawl in front of Parliament.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, this is pretty impressive. Tommy Robinson, you know, the guy who Sam Harris listened to on...
He was on Dave Rubin's show. And
on Nice Mangoes. Or no, yeah, he heard him on Sam Harris was talking on Nice Mangoes podcast about how he was big into a Tommy Robinson interview with Dave Rubin.
Yeah, because he was on Dave Rubin's show, and he seemed like a really good guy.
New center.
A lot of the right signals.
This new free speech center.
Yeah, there's a new free speech center.
Let's watch these guys free speeching it up out in front of Parliament. Jeez.
Literally.
Some of that happened last night.
He was
around here.
He was bashing the cameraman with his lighting tripod, which, I mean, when fascists use journalists' own equipment to attack them, it's a bit metaphorical, I think.
Right. Yeah, the metaphor is folding in on itself. I don't know why he would do that. He seemed like a really nice guy.
Were going after his free speech.
All right. Oh, yeah. I want to just talk about this because this is one of the few times I think I'm going to be able to. I'll be off in just a sec. This is going to be one of the few times I am going to be able to say something positive about Donald Trump. There was an executive order that changed three things about kidneys in this country. Kidney deaths, I think, are one of the top things that people die from in this country. And dialysis is a very rough thing. And the executive order, and I'm doing this from memory. The executive order dealt with three different things. One was, I think it was making organ donoring more transparent. For folks after their death, also having more parts of the cost of live donors covered. And a third element, I think, had to do with dialysis. This is going to, you know, affect several thousand people's lives a year. And with that said, I don't think Donald Trump understands the thing he's talking about, and I'm not even sure he knows where the kidney is. But here he is announcing that that new initiative.
You've worked so hard on these things. You've worked so hard on the kidney. Very special. The kidney has a very special place in the heart. It's an incredible thing. people that have to go, this people that have loved ones that are working so hard to stay alive. They have to work so hard. There's an esprit de corps. There's a spirit like you see rarely.
I have to defend Trump here.
Yeah.
I think his use of the heart is metaphorical and poetic there. I don't think he actually thinks the kidneys are in the heart. I think he has...
Are you sure?
Think so.
It's because his brother died of alcoholism.
But let me ask you a question. That would be the liver. But let me ask you a question.
The liver does a lot with the kidneys.
But let me tell you. Okay, but what does that metaphor mean? Like, when have people said, like, you know, the kidney, you know, lungs, not so much. Kidney has a special place.
Well, the lungs do less.
In his heart.
But metaphorically speaking, does the kidney have a special place in the heart? Do people go around like, I love my kidney?
Place in my heart because I care about people with kidney disease.
Yeah, maybe I care about people with kidney disease. Maybe I have more ethics than you.
Maybe
I have more concern.
I got empathy.
Would the gentleman walking by like to sit in the chair, maybe rest his kidneys? Welcome, sir.
We're going to have the best kidney here.
All right, folks. We will be back live Monday. And I think we'll probably have some extras that we may release from here. I have interviews with a lot of folks. some of which will make it onto Ring of Fire, others which we may release as a special bonus to members, and we'll figure out a way of how we're going to release this, if I can figure out how to do it, record this impromptu panel that we're going to be doing here, and see you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. Shifting in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay to play in. I know somehow the lines got graded somewhere between.